You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Today on Flashpoints, Domestic Workers' Bill of Rights signed into law. Also, a special report on the taco cart revolution in Phoenix. And we celebrate Mexican Independence Day with a special grito for our brown brothers y hermanas on the front lines of the battle for humane immigration laws, decent wages, and a safe place to live and raise sus familias. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilan Molina and the greet for you.
Ay, 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 ay.
And more on that. Stay tuned. And you're listening to a very special Friday edition of Flashpoints. And it's an honor to be here with my good brother and friend, longtime colleague, Miguel Gavilan Molina. We have an incredibly special show for you today that really only we could only do with the great support, help, knowledge, and involvement of my good brother here, Miguel. Miguel, it is Mexican Independence Day. What does that mean? What does that mean to you?
It's huge for the probably 40 million plus Mexicans or Mexican descent folks here within the United States, particularly here on the West Coast. It's a national holiday, probably celebrated more than the 4th of July. But a lot of people confuse Cinco de Mayo with Mexican Independence Day. But the reality is that Mexican Independence Day is today, and that is September 16th. And the grito is the rebel yell. It's when Mexicans from all over, be it Mexicans, Mexican-Americans, Chicanos, come to celebrate a day when Father Miguel Hidalgo y Castillo, a Mexican Catholic priest of mixed blood, known as the Father Mexican Independence, launched the revolution that led to the Spain's departure, overthrow, in Mexico back in about the 1820s. And today is that day. It's huge. It's celebrated everywhere. This weekend is going to be Independence celebrations. They started this Thursday. They'll go on all the way to Sunday, and some will happen even into next week. So it's huge.
Now, I think, by the way, is this part of it? I think there was a huge celebration in Mexico City, which they also called for the resignation of the fascist president.
Yes, yes.
Because of his Trumpian connections.
Oh, absolutely. That happened yesterday. And his failure to the Mexican people. Mexico remains one of the poorest countries, in Latin America and in the hemisphere. But reality is that Mexico isn't poor. It's just that the elite have taken control. Probably 14 families that are the billionaires of Mexico control the economy, control it all tied up to U.S. corporate interest. So that's nothing new. But today is the grito, the rebel yell for independence. As I was coming in, some people said, hey, well, you know, we got our independence from Spain back in the 1820s, and then we were invaded by the French, and we got our independence from the French in the 1870s, and then we're invaded by the United States, and when are we going to be liberated from U.S. colonial rule? I said probably in the future as the browning of America continues.
And it does continue here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We've been inside this for a long time. Did you want to share that poem?
Well, no, absolutely. And
and just explain whose poem this is.
Oh, this is a very special piece of poetry.
This is Power to the Poet.
One of my elders, of course, renowned and reverend, and that is Tata Rafael Jesus Gonzalez, or Rafael Jesus Gonzalez, Northern California, California-known poet, special poet here in Berkeley. And he sends me a piece every time there's something for what we call La Raza and La Raza Cosmica to celebrate, and of course today is that date. This is called Patriotic Poem. Mexican Independence Day, 2016. The city of Dolores, anger, rebellion, sent up by the priest Miguel that gave birth to the nation, echoes still. He carried La Guadalupe Tonatzin standard, the eagle devouring the serpent did not yet fly upon the flag. Time has ran, and when the governments bemerged the flags with blood, with abuse, with lies, what is it to love one country? The land itself that grows the corn, the forest, fields, mountains, rivers, our customs, cultures, tongues, the songs, the forms, the colors with which we celebrate life, the myths and the smell of cinnamon, until holy justice rules. Long live, always long live, the people in revolt.
You know, I last saw him, our sort of Flashpoints poet laureate, in East Oakland when Bernie Sanders came, and he was actually invited up on stage at the church there to present Bernie Sanders with a button, his beautiful Dove Peace button.
Yes.
But this is a very, very extraordinary guy. And it's, again, it's the kind of people you bring to us here on this station called KPFA that we're trying to keep going. I'm just going to tell you, I'm really hoping that you will pay attention to the quality of this program that we're doing today and the kind of material, which we've been doing for a long time. But we want to, today I'm absolutely devoted to raising the money absolutely on the premium of information. So you evaluate it. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. Please write it down, because you're going to hear a whole bunch of incredible stuff. And I just want to give it to you now. 1-800-439-5732. And of course, you know, you can subscribe for any amount on the web, get any kind of gift. You just go to kpfa.org and you click on pledge. There it is. 1-800-439-5732. Can we raise the money we need just on the information you're listening and you're deciding, wow, this is something that we do not want to disappear? We begin the show today with Salvador Reza of Tonatiera in Phoenix, the main arch enemy of the most vicious sheriff in the country, the brutal Sheriff Arpaio. This Salvador Reza has been battling this guy. He's been arrested, I think, 3 or 4 or 5 times. He's been brutalized. It doesn't stop him for a second, and he's winning. And here's an example of a victory by Salvador Reza and Tonatiera. They have now organized, right, the taco trucks. They organized the taco trucks to become a moving political action that can happen anywhere at any time. And the beautiful part is that while the sheriff and the extreme right-wingers want to arrest these people for organizing their taco carts, the people who get their tacos, a lot of white people who get their tacos from the taco carts, want them there. So let's meet Salvador Reza.
I'm Salvador Reza. I work with an organization, Tonatiera. Tonatiera is a human rights, indigenous rights organization. And back in 1999, the same thing that is happening today with Donald Trump and his underling that said that, you know, if Trump didn't get elected, there would be a taco truck on every corner. Well, that attitude started here in Arizona. In fact, the taco fight was a fight that preceded a lot of what happened here in Arizona later. And basically, it was a few right-wing neighborhoods that felt threatened, they decided that they were going to eradicate taco trucks from the city of Phoenix. And what they did, they basically got the staff to give an opinion, the city staff to give an opinion whether taco trucks were legal. They came out, and what they did is they applied an old ordinance that applies to carnivals, where they could not stay more than 4 days in any location. When they did that, they were about to eliminate close to 100 taco trucks from the city of Phoenix. So we decided to fight them back. We appealed it. We got an attorney, and we were finally able, after a year and a half and 2 years of negotiating with the neighborhood and the city, to implement an ordinance that legalized taco vending in private property in the city of Phoenix. Now everybody's into it, and now they have the Anglos and everybody else is going into the lunch truck business today. You know, it's like everybody eats tacos, but at that time, you know, they wanted to eradicate tacos.
Yeah, I mean, it is a state where there are a lot of brown people living and a lot of people who enjoy the good food that comes out of the community there. How many trucks are there? How big is the business? Say a little bit more about sort of how these trucks have become a part of everyday life.
Well, what's going on is that right now they're established industry. They basically, some of them open up all day until 1 in the morning. Some of them only open up in the afternoons. But, you know, now everybody goes to eat tacos everywhere. You know, you have the city workers going to eat tacos. You have the people on BMW going to eat tacos. It's kind of like going to, you know, to Mexico without having to leave Phoenix and basically enjoy that tradition and enjoy that cultural aspect of being outdoors and sitting in, you know, around the, you know, tables and, you know, talking and eating your tacos. So I don't know why they were opposed to it. Well, I know why. The racism was the one that's leading it.
And when you say racism, what kinds of response? We know, for instance, that a Latino supporter, supposedly Latino supporter of Donald Trump, was concerned, reported to Trump that if this keeps up, quote, there'll be a taco truck on every corner. Now, it looks like from local reports that the people of Phoenix think that might be a very good thing. But talk more about the racism and how this is really part of that bigger picture, right?
Exactly. What happens is that they usually get Tio Tacos, like Uncle Tom's, but we call them Tio Tacos. They get Tio Tacos to come in and basically side with the oppressor. And what was going on is that we had the same thing here. We had a businesswoman basically running around and saying that we were dirty, that we were filthy, that, you know, and she was a Mexican woman. So the same thing, but, you know, at the national level is going on. But the main thing is that it's going to devastate the economies of the cities, of the states, wherever this is implemented in the United States. Because what happened here in Phoenix, in the aftermath of that was SB 1070, was 287G. And with that aftermath, they basically devastated the economy. When you get rid of one taco truck, you're getting rid of six families having a job. And you're also getting rid of the people doing the transporting from Excel or from the meatpacking companies, the truckers. It's a chain. So you affect a lot of people. You not only affect the taco truck, you affect the suppliers, you affect everything else. And that is in itself, you know, it's a snowball effect where everybody gets affected. And that's what Trump doesn't realize, and that's what those stupid guys saying all of that to get votes don't realize. And they're playing on the fears of a lot of the Anglo community, that they feel their traditional places, their hamburger places, their being displaced. For example, we had a taco truck right next to a Burger King, and the people from the Burger King were upset. And the thing is, it's a different clientele, totally different clientele. But at the same time, you know, it's the same thing is happening in L.A. where Gloria Molina tried to get rid of the taco trucks on the street. And basically the same thing. And many of the people complaining were also Mexicans. But the main thing is that it creates an economic warfare against our community. And it also paints them as if we're, you know, like it's filthy and everything else. They were accusing us of having prostitutes sitting in the taco truck. But I said, well, they go to the Circle K too. So are you going to close Circle K? And they had no answer for that. And then another lady was saying, well, I went to get some a Coca-Cola, and they don't speak English. And that was the attitude, and that's the attitude that they're like trying to get. And those are the type of people that are getting to vote for Trump. Now, if they do implement it, it's going to be really bad for the, especially in California, where, you know, like, you have, you know, the cultura is so strong over there. And I think what people should do, you got to make sure that they go to the city halls and they create those ordinances and they make sure that they protect it. So then they're going to come after them with a vengeance.
Salvador, this is Miguel Gavilan. One of the things that I wanted to mention to you, because we've known that you've actually gone and started organizing the, I believe, 100-plus taco lunch wagons, you know, in the Phoenix area. And it's kind of an inspiration for the rest of the country, particularly here in California. People are looking at that, you know, after the statements that I believe Mario Gutierrez made about, you know, taco truck on every corner. It sort of like raised the consciousness. And out here in California, particularly in the Bay Area, the taco trucks just aren't, exclusively Mexican food. There's so many fusions in that Mexican food, from Thai, Asian influences to other Middle Eastern influences. So you're getting this unbelievable kind of new cuisines coming out. Some of the restaurants and established, restaurants that have been eateries for years are being either threatened or challenged. And it looks like that the new generation, the 20, 30, 40-something, wants something new. I know that out here in California, there's areas in certain cities and towns where one day a week they have all of these different taco trucks, lunch wagons come, and they have like a little mini fair going on. So people are watching closely to see what's happening there in Phoenix, because I said with the efforts there that you're doing has really begun to galvanize here people throughout the Bay Area. I know that last week there was articles in the newspapers where they said, you know, the taco wars are coming, or, you know, Taco Nation rising to resist these attempts to, you know, eradicate these efforts by really creative business, you know, industrious, you know, kind of, you know, persons from the Latino community doing something that's very prevalent and cultural in our neighborhoods. But let me ask you this. What is happening right now with the taco, vendors there in Phoenix, and how are your organizational efforts going to bring them into some kind of union?
Well, what happened is that when we organized it, we organized to fight the city, and then we had to organize to fight the county, because after we finished with the city, then the county came after us. So what we did, we basically formed an LLC, and all the taco, we had about 70 people participating in the LLC, which is, it's a nightmare, but, it's something that was to save them. And basically what happens is that now they have a commissary where they buy in bulk. They probably, like, just the central operations of the commissary are about 12 people or 15 people. They take a gross of about $5 million just in the central, on the central. And then each taco truck itself is independently owned. But at the same time, they collectively own the commissary, and by collectively owning the commissary, they can buy a lot cheaper. For example, where you have to buy meat at $4.50 a pound somewhere else, they're in the commissary, they can get it for $299 to $325. So it's huge savings for them, you know, by buying in bulk. You can set it up in a way where there's checks and balances, because once you have about 70 business people working together, it's very hard. But if you set it up right, then that's the future. Because they can actually, like, right now we probably have about 600 families living off our organization, which is La Unión Posteca de Vendedores Ambulantes. So we have about 600 families that are basically eating and living and maintaining the family and sending the kids to school through the taco trucks. So it's a huge industry. What happens and what I see in other places is that they're very, you know, like, they try to solve it on their own individualistically, and it doesn't work, because on their own they'll get destroyed. So you have to, like, do a political association to fight it, but also an economic association to maintain it. Because other than that, you cannot do that. Like, right now we can go and, you know, call for a meeting with the city manager, and we have a meeting within 48 hours. Before, they were being chased around. We can go meet with the head of the health department within 24 hours. Before, they would not even talk to us. Now they're asking the taco vendors to be on their panels, to be on their workshops. And, you know, they come and consult us whenever they're going to make a decision. So it brings a lot of empowerment. But it has to be done in a way where you set it up in such a way that it's for long term and not necessarily for short term. Because if you don't have an economic component with the political component, they'll pick you one by one.
And Salvador, this is Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel. And this is, I think, and I'd like you to respond to this. This is this kind of organization that you're working on now, this uniting of people with common interests, and this unity that's essentially brings in the white community, brings in some folks who might have been on the other side, because it sort of hits them where they live. I'm wondering if you see this movement as a sort of a cutting edge in terms of the rights of brown people and the rights of the community that plays so much of a part in life in Arizona.
It is cutting edge in the sense that, you know, the reason we call it Posteca was because the Postecas were the Aztec merchants, and they were the one that brought the culture, but they also brought in goods and everything else, and they were also fair. You know, they were fair in their dealings. And we call it Posteca because we wanted to let the city of Phoenix and the city fathers and everybody else and whoever was opposing us that this is not new. We've been merchants for thousands of years. It's not like everybody thinks that we're only like jornaleros and farm workers and all that, but that's not true. But the thing is, they don't have a concept here in the United States. Well, they do. They have corporations. But of, you know, small business collective working. And I think that's the cutting edge of it, that we have a bunch of small businesses collectively working together for the benefit of all of them. That's the cutting edge of what we have here in Phoenix with Posteca.
And you might say a fierce spirit of entrepreneurism and being entrepreneurism. You might say that they could rival Donald Trump in terms of their originality and their ability to make money, to create business where nothing was before, without a $1 million starter.
Yeah, and in fact, we went to the banks. The banks would not lend us a penny. Banks still are afraid to lend us a penny.
That might change.
But you know what? You know what? They collectively got the money among themselves and bought the commissary, you know, close to $1 million. They collectively did everything. And the thing is, we were able to get La Raza Development Fund to basically give us a loan that the banks would not give us. So these were also like organizations that were set up during the 60s can come in and be, you know, cutting edge instead of like just being playing it safe and only giving to the wealthy nonprofits and all of that. You know what I mean?
Beautiful. So, well, what comes next?
Well, what we're trying to do right now, we're trying to, out of the commissary, we're trying to do a processing plant. And that processing plant would basically, for the meat, would actually give us like a bigger market so we can actually like sell to not only to the taco vendors, which we do already, but also to the carnicerias, to the little tienditas, and basically empower small business communities that usually are left out of the big corporate, you know, big corporate economic development that doesn't take into consideration that. Because, you know, when the city of Phoenix sits down to do a planning, like a 10-year plan or a 20-year plan, whatever plan they're doing, they usually don't consider hot dog carts or lunchbox. I think from now on they're going to start doing it, but they didn't used to do it. And in fact, one time, you know, there were some young people that were participating, and I said, ask them where the taco trucks are going to be at. They did. The city didn't want to go there because it was to them, it was like bringing on the right wing against them. And the thing is, it's about time that we become legitimate business community with our own cultural input into what the community should look like. Not necessarily that it looks like with a bunch of McDonald's and a bunch of Burger Kings and a bunch of corporate food chains. We can also have our own food chains, and that's what we have here. We have, you know, when you get 100 trucks together, 100 taco trucks together, you're talking about millions and millions of dollars in the economy.
Wow. Wow. Well, that's where we're going to leave it right now. But we thank you, Salvador Reza, for taking the time out to share this incredible movement. Talk about a grassroots movement. We thank you for joining us. We thank Tony Tierra and all the great work that you and the folks do there in terms of indigenous rights, land rights. And this is a very interesting struggle right in the middle of all of it. So thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye now. Well, Salvador Reza, Tona Tierra, that's a voice, a brilliant, engaged, frontline voice for the rights of brown people, of Mexican Americans, of people, workers who are being devastated by incredibly troubling right-wing policies. And he's there on the front line. And because Miguel makes this connection, has these long-time involvement in this struggle, we have access here at KPFA. That is the taco truck rebellion. This is amazing. It's amazing, isn't it, Miguel? This is an inspiring story.
Absolutely, especially the firestorm after Marcos Gutierrez, Republican Hispanic supporter, and actually works on the campaign with Trump, made that statement.
About a taco truck on every corner.
Well, and it looks like just from people from California in now through the Southwest and across the country, people want taco trucks in their neighborhoods.
Let me just jump in here, because what I said earlier, you'll remember, Miguel, said I want to raise money on the quality and content of this show. Now, Fridays are usually our slowest day. Everybody's taking off. I'm not exactly sure why, but that's not a good enough excuse for us not to be able to raise money on the quality of this kind of programming. So if you listen, and, you know, let me say something about different pitching styles. And, this is just the way I choose to do it. Whenever possible, I'm not, you know, a content interview like that, I'm not going to break it up in four parts and do pitches in the middle.
Because you know why? People are worried. You know, that's what they're worried about, the skittish sort of listenership that might fade away because they lose their attention span after 4 minutes. But I am sure that most of the people that listen to this station and this network are not going to turn away from an interview like that. This is original. This is a rebellion happening at the roots in Phoenix, and you're not hearing about it. And it's an amazing story. And it's here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio that you hear that content. So I am really serious. Now, if we go out of here and we only raise $200, so be it. So be it. Today, Friday, it's the content. You can call 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Please write down the number, 1-800-439-5732. Or, you know this already, kpfa.org. Hit the pledge button and you're there. Now, all those gifts are available. But our gift today is this show with our senior producer, Miguel Gavilan Molina, making this kind of information available. The number is 1-800-439-5732. Will you stand up? If Miguel and I don't stand here for 10 or 15 or 20 minutes and harangue, and we mean it, and we love the work, and nobody could doubt our commitment. I know if you listen, you know. You hear in our voice, your voice. I'm asking you, I'm going to say it one more time, I'm going to put the numbers out, mention KPFA, and then we're going to go to the next interview, which is also extraordinary, and a result of the great work that Miguel does on Flashpoints. The number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Now, you know that Miguel doesn't really need anybody to speak for him. He's very good at speaking for himself. But I am proud here as the executive producer of this show to be graced by somebody of this stature who's got this connection at so many levels with the community. So the next interview we have is courtesy of my good brother here, Miguel Gavilan Molina. And this, Miguel, has to do with the National Campaign Director of the Domestic Bill of Rights, the battle for the Domestic Bill of Rights, which just passed here and now has passed in New York City. Katie Joaquim is going to join us in a moment, but this is personal for you, isn't it, Miguel? You know what it like, the work of a domestic worker, and you know what happens, don't you, firsthand?
Absolutely, Dennis. As I've shared with you, when my mother wasn't doing farm labor with the rest of us kids during the winter periods where it rained and there wasn't much field work, my mother would turn to cleaning rich people's houses. And I, as the oldest, had to go with her. And my job, which I hated, I can't even begin to explain how much I hated it, was going into these, fancy, rich, poor people's houses. And my job with my mother was to clean the bathrooms. You know, I'm 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 years old.
But big for your age.
Yeah, and I had to do that. Yeah. The worst was going to school. Like the following, you know, after the weekend, going to school the following week. And some of the kids, you know, whose houses we cleaned, the rich kids, will always, you know, ridicule, whispers. You know, I was the center of a lot of vicious jokes and blah, blah, blah. But I could sure clean that bathroom and make it sparkle. And I did it for my mother. So I do know. So I myself, when a farm worker most of the year, and then domestic worker during the winters, assisting my mother. And this thing here, Dennis, a couple of years back, the state of New York passed the Domestic Worker Bill of Rights, which was the first in the country. And this just last week, Monday, Right.
This past Monday.
Yeah, this past Monday, Governor Jerry Brown finally signed the bill.
It took him long.
Yeah, it's 78 years
to get this kind
domestic workers waiting for dignity, equality, and justice for themselves and for their families. And it's, I believe it's going to affect about 200 plus thousand workers in the state. So it's a huge victory. And on Monday, the 26th in Sacramento, there's going to be a celebration at the California
Museum.
And
we'll be there and we'll be bringing that back to our listenership here.
Which is really huge. And for those persons that hire domestic workers and appreciate the work and are thankful for having that kind of service, and help support, you know, this bill, we'd like to thank you.
Beautiful. So, again, we're going to go to our interview with Katie Joachim, but you can call just based on the quality of the program. Is this content, is this connection with the Brown community, with the soon-to-be majority community in the country? We're going to be a majority country. Won't you support the content we're bringing in, the prescience that Miguel and his vision, I can't even begin to tell you the places we get to go because Miguel opens the door. So if that's important to you and this kind of deep material is important to you, please write down the number. We're going to go back to the sound, but 1-800-439-5732. Can we do this with great mutual respect? Will you stand up for what you're hearing during this hour? Let's listen to Katie Joachim of the National Campaign for the Domestic Bill of Rights, just successful now in New York State and this week in California. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we're delighted to be joined again by Katie Joachim. She is the campaign director of Mujeres Unidas y Activas and of the California Domestic Workers Coalition. There was a major victory that Katie played a key role in, and it's pretty exciting for the domestic workers who fought this at the grassroots level. We're talking, of course, about the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. Katie Joachim, welcome back to Flashpoints. Congratulations.
Hi, thank you, Dennis.
It's good to have you with us. Remind us, what is the significance? What exactly happened here?
Sure. And so, you know, I have to say, like, the ones that played a really central role, the heart of this campaign, are the domestic worker leaders across the state. And they had been waging a 10-year fight to expand labor protections for domestic workers. They just won permanent overtime protections, which is a big deal. And they've been waging this struggle to really, you know, shift the culture in the industry to really value and recognize this work as legitimate work deserving of labor protections. It's a really huge labor victory, and it's one that has, from the get-go, been led by the women workers that are doing this work across the state.
And I want to ask you more about those women in a moment, but is this a historic passage? Talk about the overall significance here and perhaps the model it sets.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, it's absolutely historic. I mean, since 1938, domestic workers, along with farm workers, were left out of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was the landmark law set, you know, overtime, meal and rest break protections, wrote out farm workers and domestic workers, and it was rooted in the legacy of slavery in this country. You know, Southern congressmen didn't want to extend those rights to the primarily African domestic workers and farm workers. And to this day, state by state, those movements, those communities have been working to expand protections, establish basic dignified standards at their jobs. And so domestic workers fought really hard to cover the domestic workers doing personal attendant work. So nannies and people that attend to seniors and people with disabilities, there was this idea that the women that do that work do it as a source of rewarding activity, you know, supplemental income, which is absolutely not the case. These are people that are supporting their own children, their own families, not just in the U.S., but in countries around the world, and they rely on domestic work for their income and to support many other people. And so this profession is something that, you know, makes all other work possible, very important. And so the domestic workers were able to organize themselves really build a grassroots movement that could not be ignored and establish this first major step in this direction of formalizing this work, of dignifying the profession, is a major deal. And it's a testament to their incredible creativity, effectiveness, and commitment to organizing in a sector where, you know, against all odds, people may have thought it was impossible. But look at all that they've done, and look at all that we continue to do and to win.
Katie Joachim, I want to ask you about the multiple struggles, but let's go back to the grassroots, to the workers who put their lives on the line. So why don't you talk a little bit about, just give us a couple of examples of the grassroots action and what was at risk. Not only were many women in particular in danger of being hurt, already being hurt by employers because there were no controls, there was no light on the subject, if you will. But it's the idea of being undocumented and being a rebel, you're at particularly you're very vulnerable at big risk.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And, you know, we have to recognize that the organizing, the struggle that domestic workers are waging is really one about shifting culture in the industry, specifically this entrenched culture of informality, which results in unclear work agreements, an assumption that perhaps other labor rights do not apply to this workforce. And that's taxing both on the workers and also the employers. And domestic workers have been really successful in shifting consciousness around this. Around two points, like one, for the employers, you know, really working with them to understand their home is someone's workplace. There's some guidelines that can support them in being a good employer. And then two, that domestic workers, you know, they're using this profession to support their families here and in the countries that they migrated from. And so understanding the need for everyone in this industry to be able to have their needs met. And so, for the women workers on the ground that have, you know, are battling this kind of entrenched culture of informality, a lot of the burden of enforcement still falls on them, you know, in terms of negotiating what's a fair work agreement. And so what that means is that when there's this movement that's really visible, that's really effective, that's doing outreach in the parks, at the bus lines, at the libraries, that's reaching people not just about, you know, what their rights are, and the fact that they have rights and they can, you know, assert them when they're negotiating their work agreement, but also that there's this broad movement they can be a part of, and we're growing support, we're getting bigger, we're getting stronger, and we're winning. And that goes a long way, because confidence and community support when you're negotiating for working conditions, it means a lot. And without that, what it's looked like specifically around the work setup that the law that we just won affects is that these women, you know, they might have shifts that were unclear start and end times. Perhaps it was, you know, even a live-in shift, 24 hours, where you can't really get rest because you want to make sure the person you're supporting, that you're available to them when they need you. So 24/7, you're not really resting. And yet some of our members getting paid around $50 to $60 a day. And so this protection is about creating guidelines around shifts that are sustainable. Women were talking about, you know, once this bill was implemented, even in the temporary, you know, 3-year period, that their shifts adjusted so that they actually had more flexibility. They had more support so that they weren't the only personal attendant supporting one person. They hired another worker that could help relieve them. They were able to have some free time to spend with their own families. They were able to take online design courses to really expand their skills and kind of have a newfound sense of freedom. However, if they worked more, meaning they had to take more time away from their families, take more time around what makes their lives fulfilling, then they were paid fairly for that. They were paid a premium. They were paid overtime. And so this resulted in really positive impacts on the lives of women and their families that do this work.
All right. Now, I want to make sure that people understand the struggle here. So could you help us keep the human face on this by giving us a couple of courageous examples of women who had to put a lot at risk. And if you don't want to use their last names, that's fine too. But I want people to understand. I think I remember going to an event where there was a woman in her 80s who had become an activist in her 70s or something. But please share a little bit of maybe of her experience, and because we want to meet these women. Help us meet them.
Sure, there's so many stories. Emiliana, who you're speaking about, you know, someone who for the longest time didn't really get involved, was concerned or, you know, fearful or just different barriers around even speaking up against her experience of working literally 24 hours out of that 24 hours, maybe 18 hours she was actively doing work and getting paid $50 a day. She was one example of that. For her to break through, she was very scared and decided to share her story at this major rally. And it was life-changing for her in terms of, you know, being able to give voice, a lot of workers coming up to her afterwards thanking her for sharing and her being able to help to raise awareness around why, you know, why protections are so important in this industry. And her voice, you know, helping to impact other workers, you know, encourage them to get involved and to know that there was a network of support. Another woman who spoke at the labor hearing during her campaign, you know, talking about how she was a live-in personal attendant. Her partner was on, you know, was reaching his final hours, suffering from a life-threatening illness, and she wanted to go to him, and she couldn't leave her work. She called the agency and said, you know, I need to leave, but they weren't able to send a replacement to relieve her, and she had been working at that point many, many days on end, 24-hour live-in situation. And she couldn't be with her own loved one at his final hours because she didn't want to leave the person who was relying on her for support. The fact that there needs to be more of a sustainable model here, it's not really realistic to rely on one person for another human's needs 24/7. And then lastly, you know, one of the women that exemplified why permanent protections were so important, Nelia, based in Los Angeles. She also was working 24-hour shifts, 6 days a week. You know, she was working $6.25 an hour with no overtime, and she was brave enough to enter into a negotiation with her employer, along with many other workers that she helped to organize under this agency. And they entered into negotiation face to face, demanded that the employer come into compliance, pay them minimum wage, pay them overtime, and the agency wouldn't even consider settling with her because they said, you know, the laws are confusing. We want to see what happens in Sacramento. You know, kind of waiting out the sunset provision that we successfully overturned and removed. And so, now this domestic worker leader whose family depends on her income can, you know, more rigorously pursue this wage claim, and it's nearly $50,000 in unpaid overtime that has yet to be resolved. And these are all women, again, that they experience these different hardships, but they also exert tremendous leadership. They'll conduct campaign workshops, rallies. They'll do lobby visits. They'll bring their kids with them. They'll lead rallies of hundreds and hundreds of people. And they'll, you know, decide on amendments on the legislation. And they've been really the heart of this campaign. They won this campaign, and this is all about recognizing their grassroots leadership.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're speaking with Katie Joaquim. Katie Joaquim is the campaign director of Mujeres Unidas and Activas and California Domestic Workers Coalition as well. They had a major victory on Monday. That was the 12th. Governor Jerry Brown signed the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. This is huge at many levels. Just two more questions for you. First, what did we win? What did the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights win, and where does the battle go from here?
Mm-hmm. So the overtime law that applies to live-in domestic workers, which is overtime after 9 hours a day or 45 hours a week, that was applied to all the remaining domestic workers that still did not have overtime pay. So now everyone has the right to have sustainable work shifts, or if they have to work many, many more longer hours than they get paid, they get paid fairly for that overtime. And so that's what they won. But, you know, again, beyond the technical aspects of the legal protections, what they won is kind of this resounding victory that sends the message that domestic workers are building a movement that's successful, and that women across the state can negotiate with more confidence and help to really shift these standards on the ground. And so we won permanence, not the ambiguity of having a deadline hanging over workers' heads while they're negotiating for fair pay.
Are there provisions for enforcement?
There are enforcement mechanisms that exist that domestic workers are going to be able to avail of. And a lot of our work now really focuses on that type of enforcement work. a lot more outreach, education, organizing in the neighborhoods, in the places where domestic workers gather, and also in new parent groups and different adults with disability survival groups, where we're partnering with employers to also get the word out on that end. And we're advancing this new this platform called Dignity in the Home, because we know what we need is to lift up labor standards at the same time that we expand support for low-income families that need the support of a domestic worker. You know, that there's more support for people that are low-income that need a personal attendant or need assistance with childcare. We see that as interconnected. And we're working with employers, faith groups, labor unions, domestic worker groups to advance this platform called Dignity in the Home. And to anyone who's listening, whether you're a domestic worker, an employer, or, you know, you're just somebody who understands what it is to be working to make ends meet and also needing support to keep your household running, this movement is for you. And you can get involved in any of those efforts by going to cadomesticworkers.org.
And the final thing that I want to ask you is, well, it's passed now in California. It's been signed in New York. What about the rest of the country?
That's what we're working on. You know, as the more that we build strength and grassroots membership base, power, alliances, and coalitions at the statewide level, the more power that we build that we can leverage for federal wins. And we certainly have been focusing on that at the federal level, part of the campaign to expand overtime protections for companions. That was a successful victory, and many other ways that we're working to direct funds federally to states in order to develop programs that will ensure that employers that are low income can pay their workers a dignified wage. We're building the movement.
Well, that's a lot. Building the movement. Congratulations on the victory. It's been an honor to work along with you on this and to be able to keep in touch with you. We're looking forward to the premiere screening of the domestic workers
episode
of the divided TV series in Sacramento.
Absolutely. September 26th, 6 p.m. in Sacramento. All the Flashpoints listeners, of course, you, Dennis. We've been really honored also to have you all cover the campaign with us at different really important points from 2011 on to now. And so thank you also for your coverage. You should come out and join us. Everyone should come out September 26th, 6 p.m. in Sacramento.
Beautiful.
More info is on our website.
Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you. What's the website?
cadomesticworkers.org.
Beautiful. Be careful. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Dennis. Bye.
And you can bet we will talk to her soon. We'll be in Sacramento. As we speak to you now, a group of how many women?
500 women.
500 women are now marching from the Supreme Court to the White House. It's a movement called Caring Across Generations. It's the Caring Across Generations campaign. It's led by Ajahn Poo. It's being really motivated by courageous, undocumented folks who are again putting everything on the line. So that's going on even as we speak. And even as we were speaking earlier, we were reminded, and my little Bernie in my brain reminded me that we have a very special $1,000 matching fund to offer to you now. Given to us by a fan of the show, Ruth Ann Spina, who also is a contributor in the news department and is a very, very fine reporter. We're delighted because here is another example of somebody who not only gives of her time to do the work here, but she gives generously right now to the tune of $1,000, challenging you in these last 7 minutes to stand up for the programming. Does this programming, is this important to you? Is this a real alternative? The giving voice to the domestic workers, to the undocumented domestic workers who are putting their lives on the line to fight for their rights. Do they deserve a voice? Is this radio station made for them? Of course it is. It was invented for them. So, again, today, Friday here, we are trying to raise the money on the content of the show,
on the content and the quality and the originality of the show. If we're giving you information that you're not hearing anywhere else, if this is important to you, if you believe in the rights of the 12 million folks who have no rights in this country, who do the hardest labor, you know they have a voice here. So can we respectfully, based on the content, based on the information, based on our mission, will you stand with us now? Just because you have a huge premium, and the premium is the open flow of information. If that's enough for you to get you going, to put your money where your beliefs are, to maybe take an action you never took before. Maybe you've been listening 5, 10, 15 years, and you've never done it. Or you haven't done it for 10 years. We're asking you to get active, to go from passivity to activity, to join the activist nation that listens to this show and put your money where your beliefs are. I'm really hoping that you will do it because of the content of today's show. So the number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Please stand up now. Make a very big difference for Free Speech Radio. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can go right to the web, kpfa.org, click on the pledge button, and make a huge difference. Now, I would be delighted to know that you stood up because of the content, because of the material. That's what I would like to know. Do you care about the domestic workers and that they have a voice? Does that fit the mission of this station as giving voice to the voiceless, to the disinherited, to the disparaged, to the marginalized? Are we meeting our mission goal? If you think we are, if you think those are the folks that deserve a platform here, I'm asking you to pull out all the stops. It would be a real gas. 50 of you calling for $25, 25 of you calling for $50. 1-800-439-5732. And our unfortunately, a lot of people aren't calling at this point. We're in a match. Every dollar you give us now is doubled. We're in a $1,000 match. 1-800-439-5732. Miguel.
We're running out of time here, and we need your help. I'm asking you. What we presented here today, myself and Dennis are devoted and dedicated to do until we can't do it no more. Because it's transformative. It's awakening. It enriches people's lives. Celebrating Mexican independence is celebrating life, celebrating diversity, the enrichment of Mexican indigenous culture, which just isn't tacos and burritos and salsa and piñatas and, you know, the Mexican hat dance. It's much more than that. The Mexican indigenous community has been part of this landscape for hundreds of years. And at this point, we're your neighbors, we're community members, we're the landscapers, gardeners, we're also teachers, we're also public officials.
My doctor, very, very, from El Salvador, right, at Kaiser.
Right. We're very much a fabric of what's being called the New America, where it's just the complexion has changed and it's getting a little darker. But again, join us in this transformation that's happening. Embrace farm workers. Embrace domestic workers. They've made the standard of life that we're so accustomed here in California comfortable. But there's so many that are not. And we give the platform to those that are struggling just to make ends meet. Please give us a call.
1 minute. 1-800-439-5732. I'm proud. I am. This is one of the most important shows that I have ever done, Miguel. I'm very proud of it. I appreciate what you brought to this kind of show and today's broadcast. We've got about 40 seconds, and you can share with us by dialing 1-800-439-5732, kpfa.org.
we can't lose $1,000. Somebody needs to call us and donate. If two of you can, or three of you can donate $300, that's about, you know, $50 a month. We can make it.
We only need $500.
So we only need $500.
We only need $300 to make this fund. And we have
$50.
10 seconds. People can call right now, 1-800-439-5732. I think we're going to make it.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Joe Bagent died March 26 at age 65. If you've never heard of him, don't feel bad. You have lots of company. He wasn't the sort of writer or speaker that the corporate media care to publicize. In colloquial, profane, often funny, easy-to-understand language, he attacked the corruption of the system, the oppression by the capitalists and their corporations of everybody else, and the failure of democracy in America. And, almost unique among talented left-of-center people, he stood up for a neglected class, the class of poor white people, rednecks. There was no racism in this. He wrote what he was familiar with, and he was born and raised a redneck himself in West Virginia. This show is a celebration of and a memorial to Joe Bagent. I hope it will inspire you to check out his writing. One good place to start would be his website, joebagent.com. The last name is spelled B-A-G-E-A-N-T. www.joebagent.com. I can also recommend his 2008 book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War. Here's a soundbite from Joe.
Because ignorance is the darkest kind of prison. You know, it's the one you can barely escape from. I did, but I mean, you know, it's the worst kind of prison of all. And because you don't know why these things are affecting you. But you know, your angst, your confusion, your darkness is somebody's tool. And that's the business of politics. We have to recognize that politics is at least 50% dark side and getting darker, you know.
That was from a nice 2008 interview produced by American News Project. We'll hear the rest of the interview shortly. And on our show's website, you'll find a link to the video. Let's start with a nice obituary by Joe's friend, Fred Reed. Let me note that all the prose I'm reading today, I have condensed, edited, and in spots, censored for radio. Bagent moves on. We don't last, and there's no warranty. By Fred Reed. Joe lived a while down the lake. We would visit him, Vi and I, and find him, a bear of a man, writing on the porch of his one-room place in Ajijic, Mexico. Always he wore his old fishing vest. Usually we adjourned to the living room, which was also his bedroom, dining room, and salon. He would fetch bottles of local red, or make the jalapeno martinis he invented, and we would talk for hours. Sometimes he grabbed one of the guitars from the wall and sang blues, at which he was good. I guess growing up dirt poor in West Virginia puts that kind of music in you. Joe could fool you. He talked slow and southern, lacked pretensions, and you could talk to him for weeks without realizing how very damned smart he was. One day we dropped in, and he said he had just found he had cancer. It went fast. He died Saturday. Most who have heard of him have done so through his books, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War, and Rainbow Pie, a Redneck Memoir. He tells of that huge class of unnoticed people in America, the white underclass of 1,000 small towns and countryscapes, including Winchester, Virginia, where he lived. America thinks it is a middle-class country. It isn't. Joe knew. You wouldn't see it at first as sociology. Joe is more like Mark Twain. Never eat cocktail weenies out of the urinal, he said. no matter how high the betting gets. He talked of people working whole lives in jobs without benefits or retirement and generally getting screwed. He had no patience for smug commentators in Washington who were paid $500,000 a year and who talked of how America was a land of opportunity if only you worked hard. It isn't. He knew it. He lived largely coming out of the mountains and spending a year at the Corcoran School of Art, and drifting west, where his immense talent had him spending a lot of time with Hunter Thompson and the giants of the era, and writing for all manner of publications. He believed deeply in booze and recreational drugs, which in those years was perhaps not a view unique to him. He lived for years on an Indian reservation without electricity, worked as an editor for Military History magazine, likewise for an agribusiness magazine flogging pesticides. And he told horrendous stories of what we actually eat. He was miserable at military history, but needed to live. There was certainly a rural flavor to the man. Seeing a young woman with piercings in her nose and ears, and God knows where all, he commented that she seemed to have fallen face first into a tackle box. His politics may have confused the chattering classes. Joe was the least racist guy who ever lived, but he wrote about the white poor, whose very existence runs against hallowed doctrine. He was also explicitly in favor of the Second Amendment, noting that 90 pounds of dressed venison matters a whole lot to many families. These are families that book reviewers have never heard of. Joe described himself as a redneck socialist, and he was. He was profoundly concerned with the fate of the people he wrote about, those who worked hard all their lives and ended up with nothing. Funny, I've never met a socialist who didn't care about others, or a capitalist who did. It was great, brother. Hope to see you again in a few years. So ends Fred Reed's lovely obituary. Bagent moves on. Here's Joe, a few years ago, in his kitchen in Winchester. He's giving a guitar lesson to a friend. His song is called Woman, Love, and Automobile. You can see that his decision to become a writer, rather than a singer-songwriter, was a good career move. Let's hear some of Joe Bagent's stuff. Here's a section of his essay titled, If Memory Serves, Learning About Capitalism at Gunther's Garage. I read it on the show more than a year ago, and we'll hear it again now. Gunther's Garage is jammed between an unpainted shotgun shack and a weedy vacant lot on a skanky little side street in Winchester, Virginia. The place is really an illegal junkyard, but slips through the city code, masquerading as a garage. Patronizing Gunther's is not for wallflowers, gays, feminists, or Yankees. You do not go there unless you don't mind being insulted. However, one thing Gunther will not do is cheat or overcharge you. Another thing he will not do is let a vehicle fail state inspection. As the owner of an ancient, rotted-out truck with bald tires, Gunther's got my business for life. Beyond all that, Gunther is of a vanishing breed. He's one of those crusty, homegrown experts who will expound on everything, from the vicissitudes of the stock market to America as an emerging police state. Last time I was there, Gunther was reared back in his one-armed swivel chair, behind a desk piled with 7-Eleven sandwich wrappers, rusted obsolete tools, and cigarette butts, holding forth on the stock market. I'll tell you what the stock market game is all about. I didn't remember asking, but I knew I wouldn't get my turn signals fixed unless I listened. Gunther continues. Used to be a guy would pick a stock based on the facts. After a while, it got so that people looked around to see what other people's average opinion was. And they bet on that. Nowadays, you look around and try to guess what the average opinion of the average opinion is. If you can guess enough other people's guesses about other people's guesses, then you bet on that and you make money. Don't bleeping matter if the stock is a dog. The stock market now runs the whole damned economy based on what fools believe other fools believe other fools believe. What if I ran my business that way? What if all I had to do was make people believe their cars was fixed? I'd go broke. You are broke, Gunther. That's beside the point. Studs Terkel once said that writers often portray working folks as having too much worldly wisdom, so I have always tried to avoid romanticizing such people for the sake of a good column. Still, the fact is that grizzled old tradesmen do get a good lick in now and then, and Gunther gets in more than most. Gunther has been a conservative all his life, though not necessarily a Republican. He admires Kentucky Senator Jim Bunning for being against the bailouts, which to Gunther and Bunning prove socialism is alive and well in America. He says, I bombed a bunch of Koreans so I would not have to live under communist socialism. Thus proving Studs was right, that colorful working mooks are not necessarily the bearers of keen insight. Badgent continues, Gunther might be a conservative, but there are a hell of a lot of people on the left who would agree with his opinion that them what cooked up this financial mess should damned well eat it. When Gunther and other members of the petty right posed the financial catastrophe in terms of the people versus the elite group who caused it, they are using the context of class struggle, whether they use that term or not. So does the Tea Party when it talks about Main Street versus Wall Street. Would that the Tea Partiers were as smart as Gunther. The petty right and the bumbling left find themselves unexpectedly meeting one another these days as they navigate the craters of our bombed-out economic landscape. Were it not for the ideological war in progress, they would probably form a powerful combined populist movement that would scare Washington right out of its silk shorts. Naturally, political strategists on both sides do everything possible to keep the rank and file from discovering the growing overlap of liberal and conservative thinking. Not many working people on either side still believe that what is good for Wall Street is good for Main Street, or that very much trickles down from Wall Street to our level. No matter how much money we sweat for or borrow, or Congress borrows in our name without asking us, no matter how much we throw at Wall Street, the money sticks up there on the 40th floor. Our market system of investment is based upon getting in at the right moment, grabbing other people's money, then getting out fast, which pretty much describes the key elements of a bank heist. Some people understood at the time that it was a banker-rigged game from top to bottom, one that included an elite cadre of players ranging from Wall Street to the Fed, the IMF, and the World Bank. Most saw only a few aspects of the global financial growth bot, but they saw them clearly enough to raise holy hell about it, and were clubbed down in places like Seattle and Miami. When it comes to truth versus the elite's muscle, there is no contest. In a show of elite muscle, some 3,500 cops were summoned to silence the 2010 Washington, D.C. truth-tellers. That is one cop for every three protesters at the anti-capitalist convergence. Total cost of policing, steel fence, and concrete barriers and precautions came to about $30 million, or $37,500 per protester. I had many friends at that protest, and I cannot think of one who would not have stayed home for half that amount. On New World Notes, we continue our commemoration of writer and social critic Joe Bagent, who died March 26. Let's hear some more of the interview we started with. The book they're referring to is Joe's Deer Hunting with Jesus.
We've all heard a lot about the white working class vote in this election. Joe Bagent has lived the life. He wrote the highly acclaimed book Deer Hunting with Jesus. We went to Winchester, Virginia, Joe's home, to talk to him about the vote in the upcoming election.
I mean, one of the arguments that you make in your book is that the Democratic Party lost the working class vote a long time ago. Tell me why, and tell me what you think it would take for the Democratic Party to get that vote back.
there were a time when good Democrats were down there on the line getting their nose broken with labor when it was on doing, you know, strikes and things, you know, back in another era. And they forgot about those people. At some point, the Democratic Party became the hobby of the Westchester Country Club.
But in your book, you say, you know, there's this guy, this character, Tom, and you say, no one talks to Americans like Tom about universal health care, universal education, paid parental leave, affordable housing, unemployment compensation, food stamps, or Head Start. These are shameful entitlements, more damn government giveaways, in Tom's opinion, frills. But wouldn't he want all those things, ultimately? Wouldn't he want those, and wouldn't he want to be a part of a political party that wanted those, too?
No.
Why?
Because they all sound like giveaways. You know, he certainly was a embodiment of this Scots-Irish white working class ethos. I don't need anything. I don't need anything for free. There's generations of the only thing you have is your pride. Don't take anything from anybody. I don't need any kind of help. Many of these people don't have an idea of a common good. Like Tocqueville said, he said, in America, no man owes another man anything. And likewise, no man owes him.
I mean, in this election, there isn't a lot of class analysis. And the moment that Obama even starts mentioning the middle class, he's accused of some kind of class warfare.
We won't discuss it because we don't even know it's going on. We accept that the health of Wall Street is the health of our family. It's not. In fact, it's usually the antithesis of it. You know, oh, our well-being is the well-being of Wall Street. That's not true at all. There's the money economy and the real economy. What is working class in America? We've denied that there was such a thing up until very, very recent times. But the fact of the matter is, if the man tells you when to go to work, when you'll get your break, when you'll get your lunch, how much you'll get paid, whether or not you'll get benefits, and when to take a walk when he doesn't need you, I'd say that's working class, and about 70% of Americans fall into that. It doesn't matter if you're wearing a technician's coat or anything else.
So why won't they blame the corporations? You talk about the Rubbermaid factory in the book a lot.
Because they can't see them and touch them. Right. You know, they're faceless, deathless things.
But what about the Rubbermaid factory in Winchester? I mean, you talk about that a lot, about how that factory basically has stayed, which is good, but it's also, over the years, clamped down on wages, clamped down on health care, and everything else that they can clamp down on, always threatening to move to Mexico or somewhere else if the workers don't suck up the pain. Why wouldn't the workers direct their anger at the Rubbermaid Corporation, and instead they direct it at the government? I mean, the government's the boogeyman.
They can't demonize the corporations. I mean, what if you tried? Try to do something. Look around here. Is there anything that wasn't made by a corporation? Is my sustenance not delivered every day through a corporate-owned ATM? People, it is their environment. It is their consciousness. It's not just the advertisement. It's football. It's everything. These are all corporate propositions. And the constellations inside our mind, what we see, our mindscape, is a corporate mindscape. It's a corporate matrix. There isn't any bad guy over there sitting there operating it from behind the scenes. It's the thing that we have accepted, that we've chosen.
So what do you think the folks who you write about in this book, how do you think they, or do you know how they've reacted to this bailout? Do they think it's a ripoff?
There's that discontent of rising anxiety. It's getting very, like, something's going on. It's like a siren in the room, but nobody knows its name. They don't know what to call it. They don't attribute it directly to that because they're used to seeing their money spent on things they don't even know what it is. You know, nobody batted an eye when they appropriated $800 billion to the Pentagon just shortly before that. You know, nobody noticed that. But, no, I don't think it. The word bailout wasn't the best name to give it. I'm surprised that the Spin Masters missed that one.
What's Joe's version of the American dream?
Fairness. Justice. The thing that's right, you know. Working people or philosophers all have that there. It just seems to be some kind of a internal scale. And if you can go to the most fundamental level of what is just. There's no man so brute and by labor that he will not recognize that if you keep it fundamental and right enough. And I think for liberals, progressive liberals or whatever they are, you know, white, whatever they are, and that working man alike, you know, in the worst of conditions, that's the thing that's the same. And that's what Obama represents to liberals, at least the belief in it. You know, it's all rhetoric, but that doesn't mean that it isn't good, you know. Struggle is for the consciousness of the planet, the consciousness of that smear of biology on a speck of cosmic dust. There's a spiritual side of man. There's a moral side. I'm not a Christian, but it's there, and it's there for us to share as a people together.
I'm gonna build a cabin 18 stories high. Then I can watch my Donnie girl when she goes traipsing by. I won't get drunk no more, boys. I won't get drunk no more. I won't get drunk no more, boys, and walk this old plank road. That's not my key to singing.
Now, a second selection from Joe Bagent's writing, this one also previously broadcast here, more than a year ago. It's a fine piece that shows shrewd insight. It's from a long essay titled Bass Boats and Queer Marriage. This selection talks about neither, but it does talk about how our government and our corporations behave as though they were run by psychopaths. As indeed they are. Bagent and I agree on this. Consider that, in the spring of 2011, the military is bombing civilians in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and now Libya. Consider that, in the wake of the Gulf disaster and now Fukushima, the government and the corporations are pushing for more offshore drilling and building more nuclear power plants. Well, don't get me started. In any case, recent events have only confirmed Bagent's insights. Let's hear what he has to say about our psychopathic ruling elites. Bass Boats and Queer Marriage. Both political parties keep assuring us that the great American middle-class lifestyle is not negotiable, then proceed to negotiate the hell out of it. Political assurances of the sanctity of the middle class come down to promising that the 6% of the world's population called Americans may continue to rip through 36% of the Earth's resources in its endless pursuit of obesity and carcinogenic intake, not to mention taking everybody else out with us in the process through ecocide. Nobody but an unmitigated psychopath would even make such a case, much less hawk it to the American people as being in their best interests. In their best interests to wipe out our dwindling planetary sustenance and to bleep off the rest of the world enough that a significant number are willing to strap on explosives and buy a plane ticket to the States. Unfortunately, the psychopaths are in charge, and they are charging all over the rest of us like rutting bull elephants on Jimson weed. There doesn't seem to be enough Thorazine on Earth to take them down. Consequently, their delusions have escalated to the point where they believe they are exempt from planetary catastrophe. But when the planet's condition gets bad enough, and that appears to be sometime next week, their children may not be exempt. This, of course, matters not a twit to a psycho, especially if the psycho is rich, powerful, and saluted by media networks wherever he or she goes, and has not the faintest clue that he or she is a psycho to begin with. The or she refers to Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, or any of the other power-crazed, warped-out bitches who have slit enough throats to make it into that gladiatorial arena inside the Beltway. White males by no means have a franchise on naked political bloodlust. America's constellation of psychos includes just about everybody with a few hundred million bucks behind their hallucinations, from Oprah Winfrey up to Ben Bernanke. Such people presume their anointment to rule. And why shouldn't they? They've experienced nothing but success through gaming the system and the rest of humanity, raping the proles in the ear and running the nation and its institutions for their own benefit as elites. Needless to say, they do not see things that way. To them, it's just the natural order of the universe. When you are urinating down on the world from the balcony of your suite on the 44th floor, It's hard to be humble or concerned about the pissant swarm on the streets below. Even if you're not the kind of psycho our political system attracts and legitimizes, it isn't easy. Our system, owing to the magic of its checks and balances, holds all possible solutions. So we must work within the system for any desired change. So the big shots advise us. Next, the big political players, Republican and Democrat, determine some minute variation on the most current lies being sold. These slight variations are proclaimed as profound differences between the parties, because both parties' role on the political stage is to play act as opponents. So cosmetic differences are netted out and then savagely contested in the theater state as life or death issues for the American people. If you have watched old mob movies, you know that any racket needs a front. In America, the front is called democracy. Like the term populism, the people have no idea what democracy really is, but they believe it has something to do with free market capitalism. So the people are given such narrow electoral choices as not to be even real choices, but packaged in somewhat different wrappers, such as skin color. Or, if a president and Congress can see a clear path in just rolling over the rabble are given no choice at all, such as going to war against Iraq.
I use the term rednecks. I embrace it. I am one, and it's the name of a culture, among other things. And I think that they are aware that something is terribly wrong. For instance, when we saw all those red-faced people screaming, went to one of those healthcare things recently, and three people were wearing guns. Of course, if you ask them, they would say, oh, it's my Second Amendment rights. But really, something much more ominous is going on. And the screaming and the hysteria and the unthought-out, irrational theatrics that we saw are the release of an incomprehension and an anger and an anxiety going on. You know, somebody just propped them up there and pressed their button because they don't have a language to describe where their problems are really coming from. But, yeah, everybody feels it. Everybody's afraid. Nobody talks about it. I think everybody in America senses that the ground has shifted under us, that nobody knows its name. Well, we know its name. You know, it's the collapse of capitalism as we've known it, American-style capitalism.
And I wonder, how long do you think we'll wallow in these false promises of recovery before something really important cracks open? Do you think you and I will live to see the Great Correction?
No. You know, I don't think so. You know, there is no recovery in the sense, you know, yeah, the housing market's going to come back like it was. We're all going to be doing the same thing, you know, as we did before. Obviously, it proved unsustainable. Obviously, it proved to be a bubble that when it broke, shattered everything around it. But given that people, this is the only consciousness they have. This is the only world they've known, the one that they were raised in a corporate state. Personally, I know he wouldn't get reelected, but I would much have preferred to see Obama stand up, name it the way it really is, and at least, I know a lot of urban liberals and super conservatives especially wouldn't buy it, or they wouldn't want to buy it, but we all know what the truth is. Common sense tells us what's sustainable. I would rather he be noble and right than in bed with the snakes he's with.
Ending our memorial in his own words, we heard Joe Bagent, interviewed in 2009 by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, www.ecoshock.org. Thanks to all. You'll find links to everything on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. I'll get to my non-carborundum. Rest in peace, Joe, and see you later.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 Wake Up Call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Things are really heating up in terms of 9/11 truth surrounding this 15th anniversary. As the government, the prostitute media, as Paul Craig Roberts calls them, continue to spit out the lies of the official conspiracy theory of 9/11, more credible and honest people around the world are working hard to expose the truth of 9/11, the fabricated global war on terror, and other deep state events. Here are just a few of the impressive events, books, and acts of courage that are going on around the world for 9/11 truth. First, Jill Stein, presidential candidate for the Green Party, has just announced that she wants a new investigation into 9/11. Here's Cliff Judy of Newsy to tell you about it.
Jill Stein wants a new investigation into the terror attacks on September 11, 2001. The Green Party presidential candidate released a statement on her website that said, "We need to learn the full story of 9/11. Stein claims the 9/11 Commission was stonewalled by the Bush administration, saying the report contained so many omissions and distortions. And a few of the commission members did say the administration gave them obstacles. Stein points out the co-chairs of the report wrote a book saying they thought in many ways the commission was set up to fail. The 9/11 Commission was given $3 million and just over a year to complete its report, and it had a rocky start. The commission had to wait about 4 months before they could get to work. Stein vows if she's elected president, she'd create a new 9/11 Commission, not dominated by members with an interest in protecting the reputation and careers of foreign affairs and intelligence communities. For Newsy, I'm Cliff Judy.
I understand that Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein is getting a lot of flack for making that courageous statement. So if you hear someone in the prostitute media or another politician attacking Jill Stein for this statement about the new investigation, please contact them and let them know that you agree with Jill Stein. To read this article where she calls for a new 9/11 inquiry, you can go to the website globalresearch.ca. And just do a search for Jill Stein. It's a very inspiring article. I would encourage you to check it out. The second sign that 9/11 truth is breaking out is that a European journal has recently published an article about the controlled demolition of the three World Trade Center towers on 9/11. And I'm going to read to you about it from an article by Paul Craig Roberts called JFK and 9/11, The Tide is Turning. The official story is now the conspiracy theory. And here goes. In a few days, it will be the 15th anniversary of the alleged Al-Qaeda attack on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, and we are witnessing the fading protection that the charge of, quote, conspiracy theorist provides for the official government story. Indeed, the official 9/11 story is collapsing before our eyes. Europhysics, the respected publication of the European physics community, has published an article by scientists who conclude that, quote, the evidence points overwhelmingly to the conclusion that all three World Trade Center buildings were destroyed by controlled demolition, unquote. Few American scientists can admit this because their careers depend on U.S. government and military security complex research contracts. Independent scientists in the U.S. are a vanishing breed. An endangered species. The scientists say that in view of their findings, quote, it is morally imperative that 9/11 be the subject of a truly scientific and impartial investigation by responsible authorities, unquote. And a third sign that 9/11 truth cannot be silenced is the brave Colorado public TV station's recent airing of a new film called Demolition of Truth during their recent fundraising campaign. And they were giving away 9/11 Truth videos as a premium. And I understand they did very well. To learn more about that, you can go to their website, which is ctv12.org. So again, that's C as in Colorado, ctv12.org. And another example of how the truth about 9/11 and the fabricated global war on terror cannot remain hidden is because of authors who have the courage to write books revealing the truth. Today, I'm going to tell you about three of those. One is Christopher Bullin's two companion books called Solving 9/11. There's a very organized effort to censor him on his latest speaking tour in the U.S. by attacking the venues and threatening them. These efforts to censor have been partially successful, so please check out Christopher Bullin's book, Solving 9/11. And another book is by Lance DeHaven Smith called Conspiracy Theory in America, published by the University of Texas Press. Here's what Paul Craig Roberts has to say about this book. Conspiracy Theory in America tells the story of how the CIA succeeded in creating in the public mind reflexive, automatic stigmatization of those who challenge government explanations. This is an extremely important and readable book, one of those rare books with the power to break you out of the matrix. And the third book is by Dr. David Ray Griffin. It'll be released sometime in October of 2016. As many of you know, David Ray Griffin has written 10 books on 9/11 and has been a key figure in the 9/11 truth movement. His latest book is titled, How Bush and Cheney Ruined the World. And I'm told that the first two-thirds of the book are about Bush and Cheney, and the last third is about the miracles of 9/11, as he refers to the official story, you know, of being full of miracles and not scientific fact. There were many 9/11 truth events held around the U.S. on September 10th and 11th, but the biggest one was in New York City at Cooper Union, and it was called Justice in Focus, and their website is justiceinfocus.org. And I'll be sharing some of the speeches with you on future broadcasts from that event. Many of them are already up on YouTube, or you can catch them at their website, justiceinfocus.org. I do caution that I don't support the efforts by some in the 9/11 truth movement to blame 9/11 on the Saudis. They have done this by supporting former Senator Bob Graham in his efforts to release the 28 pages of the Joint Congressional Inquiry. And here's a recent interview between James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com and Michelle Chusadovsky, one of the co-founders of the website globalresearch.ca. If you listen to them, you'll understand why working with former Senator Bob Graham around these issues does not promote 9/11 truth. So here they are, James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com and Michelle Chusadovsky, co-founder of the wonderful website globalresearch.ca. This interview comes from Global Research TV.
As we reach the 15th anniversary of 9/11, the establishment is attempting to derail 9/11 truth with disinformation about Saudi Arabia. But as Michelle Chosadovsky of globalresearch.ca points out, if we ever hope to derail the never-ending war on terror, we must be absolutely clear that neither Al-Qaeda nor Saudi Arabia could have pulled off the attacks of that day.
The tragic events of September 11, 2001 constitute a fundamental landmark in American history, a decisive watershed, a breaking point. Millions of people have been misled regarding the causes and consequences of 9/11. 9/11 marks the onslaught of the global war on terrorism, used as a pretext and a justification by the United States and its NATO allies to carry out a war without borders, a global war of conquest. A far-reaching overhaul of military doctrine was launched in the wake of 9/11. 9/11 was also a stepping stone towards the relentless repeal of civil liberties, the militarization of law enforcement, and the inauguration of police state USA. Endless wars of aggression under the humanitarian cloak of counterterrorism and the responsibility to protect are set in motion.
So we are now at 9/11/2016, 15 years after the initial events. Tell us, in your estimation, where the 9/11 truth movement has come to in terms of its consensus on the key understandings of what happened on that day.
Well, I think the fundamental consensus which was reached several years ago was that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda could not, under any circumstances, have brought down the buildings, because those buildings were brought down through controlled demolition. And then, of course, there was the issue of Building 7, which collapsed in the afternoon of 9/11. And that, in effect, was barely covered by the media, as we recall. And again, no questions asked as to why a third building, which was not the object of attack, which had only small debris of fire, etc., all of a sudden had collapsed. And very significant, the media, both CNN and the BBC, announced the collapse of Building 7 at least 20 minutes before the actual occurrence, which points to, quote, a conspiracy at the highest levels, including, of course, the media itself.
So given this base-level understanding that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda could not possibly have organized the demolition of those buildings that did take place on that day, what do you see as the outcome of the latest narrative that is being injected into a lot of erstwhile alternative media right now that is seeking to pin the blame not on al-Qaeda, but now on Saudi Arabia, given the commotion we've seen from Senator Bob Graham and others in recent months and years about the 28 pages that were recently released?
Well, these 28 pages constitute, in a sense, a tacit mechanism whereby the narrative, the original narrative, which has largely been refuted, can be reinserted. And in fact, it infiltrates the 9/11 truth movement. I've noticed that many scholars and analysts of 9/11 are prepared to accept it and don't understand the underlying logic. First of all, it has to be mentioned that Bob Graham and Porter Goss are very much involved in the propaganda process of 9/11. And that goes back to August 2001, when they visited Pakistan and met up with the head of ISI, in other words, Pakistani intelligence, General Mahmoud Ahmad. And then they returned to Washington. And then it just so happens on the morning of 9/11, they were having breakfast together with General Ahmad when it actually happened. Now, at the time, of course, we looked to this ISI connection, Pakistani intelligence, in the sense that ultimately we believed that ISI was a sponsor of the 9/11 attacks. We spoke of the money man behind 9/11, which was Mahmoud Ahmad. And then we were led to believe that the ISI was in fact sponsoring the hijackers and so on and so forth. But we also knew that those hijackers, al-Qaeda, alleged hijackers, were linked to the CIA. And in other words, to say that al-Qaeda is behind the 9/11 attacks ultimately points to the fact that the CIA was involved, because they are, and they have been since the late 70s, they've been the sponsors, the intelligence sponsors of al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda is an intelligence asset. But in retrospect, Bob Graham and Porter Goss were involved in what we might describe as the preparation of a propaganda campaign, of which the purpose was actually to sustain the legend that al-Qaeda was behind it. Okay? Now, there's another very important occurrence which has long been forgotten. Dan Rather, CBS News, in an authoritative report, confirms that on the 10th of September, 2001, the leader of al-Qaeda, namely Osama bin Laden, was admitted to a Pakistani military hospital in Rawalpindi. Now, anybody who has been to Rawalpindi knows that this is a military city. It's the headquarters of the military intelligence. It's swarming with U.S. military advisors. And then, of course, in the wake of 9/11, they say, where is Osama bin Laden? We can't find him. And then the historic words of Donald Rumsfeld at the time, it's like looking for a needle in a stack of hay. We don't know where he is. But that was a lie. They knew perfectly well that on the 10th he has been admitted to a Pakistani military hospital, which was within walking distance of the U.S. military missions, and that he could not reasonably have coordinated these attacks, admittedly if he coordinated, but he should have been present in some form or another, presumably from his laptop, you know, in the hospital. But the issue is that his whereabouts were known. He was admitted on the 10th. I don't have confirmation as to when he was released, but assuming he was released on the 11th, normally he would have been arrested immediately, and he was not. So that this, in effect, is also another element. There are many elements, but that is a notorious element. The whereabouts of Bin Laden were known. He could have been arrested, and then the saga would have been over. But that didn't happen. What did happen, because the propaganda campaign was launched, is that on the 12th of September, NATO, the Atlantic Council, its governing body, intimated that the United States had been attacked by a foreign power. They didn't mention the foreign power, but the foreign power was Afghanistan. Now, I didn't see nobody saw any Afghani jets in the streets, in the skies of New York that particular day. So that what they had done is to invoke Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, which is the founding document of the Atlantic Alliance, namely NATO, and then use this under the doctrine of collective security to announce a war against Afghanistan on the grounds of self-defense. Now, a couple of very crucial elements behind this. One is that through diplomatic channels, the Afghani government, which the Americans call the Taliban, they contacted the U.S. State Department and said, if you wish that we facilitate the extradition of Osama bin Laden and you provide us some grounds that he might have been involved in these events, we'll gladly enter into collaboration with you. And this offer from the Afghani authorities was made on two separate occasions to George W. Bush, and his response was, we do not negotiate with terrorists. In other words, they refused to extradite Osama bin Laden to the United States for a legal procedure. And instead, they proceeded in a criminal and a legal invasion of a sovereign country in Central Asia. Now, another important dimension to this whole saga is that you do not prepare a theater war in Central Asia, thousands and thousands of miles away, in less than 28 days. Impossible. Okay? So in other words, from the 11th of September to the 7th of October, you are not in a position from a military standpoint. Every military analyst knows it. All those who are on contract to the major media organizations, they know that military planning takes a lot of time. In other words, that war on Afghanistan was prepared before 9/11, not after 9/11.
And just to further back up what you're saying there, I'll direct the viewers to National Security Presidential Directive 9, which was officially signed on October 25th, 2001, and was the national security directive devoted to eliminating the Al-Qaeda network and using all elements of national power to do so, including military. But that was signed on October 25th, 2001. It was presented to the president on September 4th, 2001, 1 week before 9/11 occurred. So just to back up your statement about the military planning that obviously went into the invasion of Afghanistan in October of 2001, given 9/11's role as the fundamental event which set in motion these borderless wars of aggression and the consolidation of the police state within the United States and the panopticon level of surveillance that has taken place in the name of protecting and securing the public from this imaginary terror threat, what then do you say to those who say that we're 15 years past this event, it's time to give up on 9/11 as a rallying call for activism or a way of trying to divert what's happening right now?
No, I think that 9/11 is absolutely fundamental because the narrative, the official narrative, the propaganda narrative is extremely fragile. And if we can break that consensus that Al-Qaeda is the outside enemy of the Western world, and that Muslims, you know, and Muslims are killing our people in various terrorist attacks in European cities and so on and so forth, then we break the consensus. We show, in fact, that Al-Qaeda is being used as a pretext and a justification to wage war. But there's another element. We know for a fact that that decision directive, which you mentioned, was never implemented. Quite the contrary. Immediately after the 9/11 attacks, the United States and its allies, through various mechanisms, has consistently supported Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda networks, throughout, I mean, not solely in the Middle East and Central Asia, but in sub-Saharan Africa with Boko Haram, in the Maghreb, in Libya, in Syria. They support the ISIS. They support the Al-Qaeda-affiliated opposition. They support the moderate terrorists. Now, if they had been consistent in defining their counterterrorism role, they would have gone after these guys. They didn't. Quite the opposite. And it would have been very easy to liquidate the ISIS, Daesh convoys and the Toyota trucks when they crossed from Syria into Iraq with no, absolutely, with conventional weapons. The U.S. Air Force could have come in a matter of 20 minutes, they would have liquidated them. So again, we have a whole series of events which lead to the extension of this global war on terrorism. But you see, what is now happening with the 28 pages is that they say Saudi Arabia is involved. Now, that is really a way of shifting the blame in the state sponsorship of terrorism to a foreign power with a view essentially to creating a vacuum in terms of any kind of police investigation as to who might be responsible. And I'm not going to say who is responsible because I think that has to do with the police investigation. All we can say at this stage is the official narrative is a lie. It's based on fabrications. It doesn't stand up. It has been refuted. And the next stage is, of course, that police authorities respond to their mandate and conduct an investigation. Without 9/11, they would be in great difficulty in waging the wars in Syria, Yemen, and other countries around the world, because the 9/11 consensus provides them with the pretext. It's a war of self-defense. We're being attacked, and so on and so forth. And that is why 9/11 ultimately is so important in terms of what is happening today, which is a war without borders, a globalization of war.
We have to break this myth of 9/11 to really untangle all of the webs that have been weaved around it over the years and all of these wars that are going on right now. So on that note, we'll direct people, of course, to globalresearch.ca, where they will find enormous amounts of information, not only, of course, about 9/11 and related aspects of what happened on that day, but, of course, everything that's happening around the world as a result of that day as well.
And again, you were just listening to an interview on GRTV between James Corbett of The Corbett Report and Professor Michelle Chusudovsky of globalresearch.ca. So it seems to me that the people who planned and pulled off 9/11 must be getting a little nervous right about now, with so many people from around the globe researching the facts, challenging the official story, and sharing the truth through books, videos, websites, and conferences. And it even appears that the term the powers that be have used to squash discussion of 9/11 and other state crimes against democracy, this term isn't as effective as it used to be, because researchers are also sharing the origins of that term. You know the term, conspiracy theorist. And now I'd like to read you a few excerpts from an article written by Paul Craig Roberts called "The Conspiracy Theory Narrative. Are You a Mind-Controlled CIA Stooge?" And here goes. Do you smirk when you hear someone question the official story of Orlando, San Bernardino, Paris, or Nice? Do you feel superior to 2,500 architects and engineers, to firefighters, commercial and military pilots, physicists and chemists, and former high government officials who have raised doubts about 9/11? If so, you reflect the profile of a mind-controlled CIA stooge. The term conspiracy theory was invented and put into public discourse by the CIA in 1964 in order to discredit the many skeptics who challenged the Warren Commission's conclusion that John F. Kennedy was assassinated by a lone gunman named Lee Harvey Oswald, who himself was assassinated while in police custody before he could be questioned. The CIA used its friends in the media to launch a campaign to make suspicion of the Warren Commission report a target of ridicule and hostility. This campaign was one of the most successful propaganda initiatives of all time. The CIA's success in controlling public perception of what our founding fathers would have regarded as suspicious events involving the government enables those in power positions within government to orchestrate events that serve hidden agendas. The events of September 11 created the new paradigm of endless war on behalf of the Washington-dominated world. The CIA's success in controlling public perceptions has made it impossible to investigate elite political crimes. Consequently, it is now possible for treason to be official U.S. government policy. And again, that was from an article called The Conspiracy Theory Narrative, Are You a Mind-Controlled CIA Stooge? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. And I'm going to end the show today with a song by Martin Noakes called 9/11 Building 7. And here it is.
There's a million reasons why I don't believe it. There's a million reasons why it can't be true. Open fire, can't melt steel. It's not hot enough. It's nothing new, it's not a mystery. Check out the Reichstag, Germany. There's a million questions still. Like the towers, it just fell. The fire's not enough. No way hot enough to bring it down. The project for the new American century was added to a year before that day. It states in order to proceed, a
stuff. They made that clear enough. So now it's up to us to bring it down.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, home attendants demand their stolen wages and an end to mandatory 24-hour shifts. But first, the prevalence of racism in the labor market and what is to be done.
Well, the so-called recovery of the U.S. economy has not been equally kind. No, it hasn't, to everyone. Even as the unemployment rate generally has decreased, the unemployment rate for African Americans is currently more than twice as high as that for white Americans.
Indeed, nationwide in 2015, 9.6% of African Americans were unemployed, compared with 4.6% of whites. This 2-to-1 ratio of African Americans to white unemployment has persisted for at least the last 50 years. This unemployment gap is not one because of skill or education. It's because of the very real and persistent discrimination prevalent in the U.S. labor market.
Did you know that it would take 228 years for African-American families to amass the wealth of white families? Well, we're joined now by William Spriggs, chief economist of the AFL-CIO and professor in and former chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University. And Bill was also former assistant secretary of the Office of Policy at the United States Department of Labor. We're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bill, I want to get into the unemployment situation because it seems as if people sort of expect that the African-American unemployment rate will be twice the white rate and that people don't question it anymore. This is the way it is. It's like this is almost normal. And this has been going on since Dr. King was talking about it in 1967 and before that. Is this a result of discrimination? Is there something in the labor market that's forcing this? Is there something we can do about it?
Well, the labor markets have a huge amount of discrimination in them. And we know there's a huge undercurrent of discrimination, just built-in bias in our system. Look at the 30% hardcore polling that Donald Trump gets. The bulk of it just because he openly says things that are racist. This is a reality we have to understand goes over to the labor market and the way that people view job applicants. And so if you're going to face a constant drumbeat of about 30% of employers not wanting to hire, then you're going to find that blacks are going to find it much harder to get jobs, and you're going to get a phenomenon where no matter who you put in front of them, skilled, unskilled, well-educated, less educated, you're going to find that the system isn't going to work properly. What we do see over the course of our recessions and then employment booms is that when the employment booms come towards their end and we have a lot fewer people looking per job opening, that the level of discrimination falls. So when the labor market is really slack, blacks who are much better educated than whites have much higher unemployment rates. Most of this downturn since the Great Recession, blacks with associate degrees had unemployment rates that were higher than white high school dropouts. Blacks with an associate's degree had higher unemployment rates than white high school dropouts. Now that the labor market has had 78 straight months of job growth, and we're finally getting to the point where job lookers per job opening is getting tighter, blacks with associate degrees have a lower unemployment rate than white high school dropouts, and they're now pretty much on par with white high school graduates. If we let the labor market continue to tighten, then that's going to improve. But invariably, when we get really close, the Federal Reserve thinks the labor market is at full employment. They raise interest rates. The labor market slows down, and black people start losing jobs. And we never get to parity. What also happens is that when the labor market gets better, then blacks with less education who give up because their unemployment rates are too high finally come into the labor market. So the black unemployment rate is sensitive to how well the labor market performs, and so the black line gets longer when the labor market improves because people who are discouraged finally come back in and start looking, and that's what's been happening over the last couple of months. In fact, since the recovery, the black employment-to-population ratio has gone up over 10%. A lot of people have ignored this because they look at the 2-to-1 unemployment rate, but the share of blacks working has actually been going up. For whites, it hasn't changed very much because white labor force participation has stayed about the same. And so the share of whites employed has only gone up a tiny amount, whereas for blacks it's gone up a very substantial amount. So tight labor markets do make a difference. They do lower market discrimination. They do make it easier for blacks to find jobs. But the anomaly you can see clearly in the data, the old adage, blacks have to be twice as good, and that's what shows up in the data. You have to have the associate's degree, you have to be twice as good in order to get the unemployment rate of a white person who's less educated. And until we shake discrimination out of the labor market, that's not going to change. And what that does is, of course, that when blacks do get jobs, two things. One, blacks know that they have a much higher chance of being unemployed, so they're much willing to take lower-wage jobs. And once blacks are employed, we also see that blacks don't quit. And quit rates are a helpful way for people to get higher wages. But blacks are very reticent to quit because it's just too hard to find a job.
You know, what I was thinking about was the kind of intersectionality that, for example, people from the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, the first and indeed the second one, or even the Black Panther Party's 10-point platform, they talked about the economic demands along with demands for racial justice as kind of a dual agenda of black freedom movements. So I was thinking about the Eric Garner situation and blacks being forced into the underground economy because of the discrimination in the job market as one way of understanding the additional pressure and tension that they face with the policing apparatus. So with that, is there that – are we still about, and should we kind of make sure that our demands for the rectification of the discrimination and so on inherently include a kind of social justice, racial justice component along with economic policy that is specific to the needs of the African American community?
Well, yes, it has to be. It has to address this level of discrimination because it hurts everyone. When the Federal Reserve thinks we're at full employment, but black people with associate degrees are facing the labor market that whites who are dropouts face, that's not full employment. That's not letting wages rise. When there are unemployed, skilled unemployed workers on the sideline, employers keep wages down because they know they can go get somebody else for less. And that hurts everyone. So we have to have a vision of economic justice that does not allow for this level of discrimination in the labor market. But more than that, again, in the case of Eric Garner, people can watch a video of someone being arrested in New York over taxes on cigarettes and see the level of police force put to play, while HSBC Bank, the huge European bank that got convicted of laundering 800 and some million dollars worth of drug money, no police showed up, not a single one. So if the police are going to show up in force for someone who cheated on cigarette tax, but they're not going to show up on people who laundered over $800 million worth of drug money, then, you know, how are we to think this is a just society? And if jurors can watch that video and see someone beg for their life and be killed over cigarette taxes, and then their answer is, eh. I mean, that's really was their response. Like the police killed a cockroach. Then you can't believe that those same jurors, when they would get a job application from a black person, could treat them fairly. They didn't think that Eric Garner deserved to live, so they clearly can't think you deserve a job. So I think of the connection more in terms of what it says about our sense of justice. And the complaint in the South was that police knew that they could do this and nothing would happen to them, that black lives had no value, that no one had to be held accountable for actions that took away black lives. And economics is a way to take away lives. The unemployment rate for black high school dropouts is violence against the black community. That unemployment rate is not the unemployment rate of any other set of high school dropouts. Any. It's not close. That's economic violence.
So how do we deal as a society with that economic violence? Is there a legal mechanism? Are there targeted programs? What is to be done?
Well, I think we have to get more serious about it. We have to have testers in the labor market, as was the case with housing. That's the way we detect discrimination in housing. And for high school educated workers and for high school dropouts in particular, these are jobs which presumably many people would qualify for. They're not requiring computer skills at a high level. And so we should have testers out to see what our employers are doing. Are they discriminating? It is against the law. The whole point of the March on Washington was because President Kennedy, in proposing his Civil Rights Act, had left out the key provision on ending discrimination in employment. And John Lewis was going to be censored in his speech because he was attacking that part of Kennedy's bill. They asked him to tone it down a little bit. Don't go after President Kennedy too hard. Lewis still criticized the president, just not as hard as he had in his original draft. But that was the victory of the march, was to say we must end employment discrimination. And Title VII, the creation of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to attempt to give some teeth to it, had impact, at least in the public sector. We know that discrimination in the public sector reduced dramatically after the Civil Rights Act passed, and it was one of the key reasons why black poverty fell, because we were able to have the Justice Department go after fire departments, police departments, city hospitals, sanitation jobs, and find entryways for black workers into that arena. And then we had the minimum wage apply to those public sector jobs, which at the time, if you made the minimum wage, you couldn't be poor, because if you worked full-time at the minimum wage back then, at least you could support yourself. So these were real victories. But in the private sector, we have lagged behind, and so many jobs are in the private sector, that level of discrimination remains.
Bill, would a federal – these are some of the proposals that have come out of a document put together by M4BL, Black Lives Matter. And they were talking about federal and state jobs programs, the right for workers to organize, and reparations for past harms as economic reforms fundamentally. Do they – and would these things materially change the conditions in Black communities as you see it?
A huge problem for the Black community is the lack of wealth. And there's no serious way to close the racial wealth divide without having somewhere on the table a discussion of reparations, because the accumulated effect of discrimination in the labor market, discrimination in the housing market, access to higher education, those accumulated over years. And so you cannot expect in a short window to erase that. Some people have put out that would take about 200 years. That's not workable, and it's not meaningful for the nation, because we know that so many things connected to wealth make a difference. The vitality of our cities and their tax base. Baltimore would look different. Detroit would look different if Blacks had the same level of home ownership and the same level of wealth. The tax base would look that different. You know, there are huge sections of New York that would look different. So it hurts everyone that these revenues aren't present because of that wealth gap. So somewhere on the table, some discussion has to be about what do we do about this wealth gap in a serious way. But going forward, the gap needs to close, and the gap can only close if we don't have discrimination in the labor market, if we don't make mistakes about the way we try and make college affordable, if we can correct what's going on now in the housing market, where the banks are using standards, not pre-bubble, but higher standards that aren't necessary, that seem to be locking out Black and Latino homeowners from recovering from all the damage done to them by the banks in the run-up to the crisis.
We want to thank you for being with us and sharing some of your thoughts. You're always insightful and helpful in understanding the particularities of discrimination against the African-American community, the wealth disparities, and ideas about what is to be done for real job programs and the creation of wealth. We've been speaking with William Spriggs, who serves as chief economist to the AFL-CIO and is a professor in and former chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University. Bit of Esmeralda Spalding. Well, home attendants who have worked as long as two decades for First Chinese Presbyterian Community Affairs Home Attendant Corp, caring for elderly and ill patients in their homes, were forced to work for what amounted to 24-hour shifts for as many as 7 days a week, but were paid for only 12 or 13 of those hours. The workers were also denied overtime pay, but they weren't taking it lying down. Joined by workers from the Chinese American Planning Council and other home care agencies, the FCP home attendants are demanding that FCP resolve their case immediately by giving them back their stolen wages. And they're headed to court to back up their demands. Let's join the Ain't I a Woman campaign of the National Mobilization Against Sweatshops, organizing the workers to realize their demands. To the picket line.
No more 24 hours! No more 24 hours! No more 24 hours! No more 24 hours!
We're here today because the home attendants who are employed by the First Chinese Presbyterian Community Affairs Home Attendant Corporation right here in this building. The home attendants have filed a lawsuit against their employer because they have been working 24-hour shifts and only getting paid for half of that. Their patients are Medicaid patients who have been approved through a rigorous process to receive 24 hours of care. That means care day and night. And so these workers have been having to work 24 hours of work so that they can provide care for their patients. This is terrible for both the workers and the patients. And on top of it, the workers are not getting paid their fair share or the full amount of hours that they've been working. We're here today with the workers of the First Chinese Presbyterian, but there's also workers from all over, lots of different agencies, both in New York City and upstate, who have been facing the same conditions. We've come together as an Ain't I a Woman campaign because many of us are forced to work long hours. Many of us are caregivers in various capacities, and these conditions are just completely unacceptable. We're going to start with our first speaker today, Elida Agustino Mejia Herrera.
¿Cómo está? Soy Elida. Trabajé en First Chinese por 15 años como cuidadora en el hogar.
I worked at First Chinese for 15 years as a home attendant.
Por 15 años, la mayoría del tiempo trabajé 120 horas por semana, pero ellos pagaron por solo la mitad de esta hora.
For the majority of the time, I worked 120 hours per week, but they only paid me for about half that time.
Trabajamos muy duro para esto, pero estamos robados de nuestro pago. Por eso nos juntamos y demostramos y demandamos a First Chinese para nuestro pago robado. No es justo. Nos han robado tanto. No es justo. Nos han robado mucho tiempo.
We work hard, but they only are stealing our pay. For this reason, we came together to sue First Chinese Presbyterian for our stolen wages. It's not just, it's not fair that we work so hard and they steal our wages.
Hemos trabajado mucho para no ser pagado.
We work hard and then not getting paid.
Thank you, Elida. Sorry, next we have Alvaro Ramirez Guzman.
Buen día, mi nombre es Álvaro Ramírez Guzmán. Trabajé por 5 años, turno 24 horas. Siempre decían que pagaban las 24, pero nunca la pagaron. Todo ese dinero atrasado, esperamos que lo devuelvan. Dicen que 24 horas se duerme, no se duerme, porque hay que estar detrás del paciente con la medicina, el cambio de pamper y las 24 horas detrás de ellos. O sea que es mentira todo.
My name is Alvaro Ramirez Herrera. I work for First Chinese Presbyterian. I worked as many as 96 hours a week and working hard. We had to change the pampers of the patients. We had to take them, give them medicine. We had to take them to the bathroom. We could not sleep. It's a lie that we could sleep. We worked hard for this. We should be paid.
También de 24 horas, siempre dice pagan 16, pero no pagan, no hay mucho dinero atrasado y eso esperamos esa recompensa y por mucho la unión hace la fuerza y esperamos que se unan más en esto.
So we work these 24 hours, but they say they pay us some, but it's not true. We need to be paid for all the hours that we worked. We want our old wages from all the work that we did before. And we want everybody, others, to join us.
Okay, gracias. Esperamos respuesta y que todo se solucione.
Thank you, and I hope that we can be strong and resolve this.
Queremos nuestro pago por sobre tiempo. Queremos nuestro pago por sobre tiempo.
Come yo, somos.
Come.
Somos yo.
Siéntate.
Next we have Leticia Panama Rivas.
Bueno, lo que le quiero decir que First Chinese tiene trabajando gente 24 horas y muchas compañeras, como en mi caso, nos hemos lastimado en el trabajo. Sufrimos estrés porque tenemos que hacer muchas cosas por esos pacientes de las cuales solo pagan 13 horas y el resto de las horas no la pagan. Entonces, Si usted trabaja 24 horas, de las cuales le paga 13, entonces el resto de las horas, que son como 11 horas, que supuestamente ellos no la pagan porque 8 horas son de descanso, supuestamente que uno duerme y las otras 3 horas son del break. Dígame, si a ese paciente le pasa algo en la noche, ¿contra quién se van a ir? Contra la home tenda. Y no solo por la home tenda, por muchos trabajadores que están siendo explotados a nivel nacional, y queremos que esto pare y nos paguen las horas que nos debe, que son las 24 horas que por regla que el gobierno exige que nos paguen, y nosotras también tenemos que hacer valer nuestros derechos. Gracias.
I work for First Chinese working 24 hour shifts, and we work very hard. I got for all these hours of working and all the stress, I got injured, and there are a lot of people like me. But it's not fair. We work these 24 hour shifts and they only pay like 13 hours. They say supposedly that the other hours are for resting. But if we rest and something happens to the patient, then who's going to be held responsible? Us, the home attendant. We've got to come together. We've got to say to the government, you've got to pay us for all the hours that we work. Thank you.
Thank you, Leticia.
Páguenos nuestro overtime. Páguenos nuestro overtime.
Next we have Virtudes Duran.
Mi nombre es Virtudes Duran. Trabajé por 17 años en la Fachaní. Trabajé 24 horas todo mi tiempo. Trabajaba 24 horas por 4 días. Primero trabajaba 5 días. 8 y 7 días, pero después me pusieron a trabajar 4 días, 24 horas, por siempre, por 17 años. Y yo quiero que me paguen mi dinero que me tienen, que perdí en todo ese tiempo. Gracias.
My name is Victoria Duran, and I'm here because I worked for 17 years at First Chinese. I work very hard, 24-hour shifts, some 4 days a week, and before even 5 days, even 7 days a week. I'm here because I want my pay for all those hours worked. They gotta pay us now.
Thank you. I'll just wrap up by saying that the work that the home attendants have been doing is hard, intense, incredibly stressful, and to only get paid for part of that time is ridiculous. And we demand that First Chinese Presbyterian pay their workers. And also, when the workers have asked for less than 24-hour shifts, they have been told, given very few hours, then not being able to make a living off of that. So basically, they're forced into 24-hour shifts, which is absurd. And then to not get paid for them is absolutely absurd. Thank you for coming out today.
Pay the workers now! First Chinese! Pay the workers now! First Chinese!
And Ain't I a Woman, the Ain't I a Woman campaign of the National Mobilization Against Sweatshops, organizing workers to demand their rights. Give them those wages back. Support these home care attendants.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
There is something about the institution of marriage which still strikes at the hearts and minds of some heterosexuals as something which is just a big social institution that can't be changed.
Oh, bad news, we lost. I was frustrated and angry and sad. And I think the thing that hit me the most is I took it a lot more personal than I thought I would.
It's more important for you to be who you are than to try to be what you think other people expect you to be.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucy Chappell. Australia's opposition throws marriage proposals into the plebiscite mix. TV's Gay Asian gets away with visibility. And a disappointing defeat derails Canada's queer decade. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending September 3rd, 2016. The Australian Parliament opened its 45th session on August 31st with Liberal Party Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull's Conservative government in coalition with the farther-right Nationals, holding a razor-thin one-vote majority following July's national elections that saw gains by opposition parties. Before he unseated his party's staunchly anti-marriage equality PM, Tony Abbott, Turnbull had publicly opposed a national plebiscite on the issue. But in order to win the backing of the National Party in his coalition government, Turnbull backpedaled to support the popular vote on whether or not civil marriage should be open to gay and lesbian couples.
Australia's leading opposition Labour Party, along with the farther left but significant majority Greens and a handful of independent MPs, have joined forces to oppose the $160 million plebiscite, charging that it's a waste of taxpayer money to hold a popular vote on the issue when polls consistently confirm that civil marriage equality enjoys the support of more than two-thirds of the public. They also object to the plebiscite because, as proposed in the legislation to formally approve it, even if the expected overwhelming majority is in favor, MPs will not be required to ratify those results when they vote on a civil marriage equality bill to follow.
Labour Party leader Bill Shorten hinted during a press conference last week that his MPs might join the Greens in officially opposing the plebiscite. A Labour-Greens coalition, along with three independent MPs who are on record as opposed to the national vote, could scuttle the plebiscite before it can even be held. Meanwhile, Labour, the Greens, and two independent senators each introduced competing bills this week to legislate marriage equality. Prime Minister Turnbull's approval rating has plunged even further since the July 2nd national elections. 52% of those surveyed this week by the Australian newspaper disapprove of the job Turnbull is doing, up 5 points since the elections. He has nevertheless refused to back down from his support for the civil marriage equality plebiscite that might now never be. He's also refused to give his government's MPs a free vote on any civil marriage equality legislation.
Bermuda's Supreme Court has agreed to hear a civil marriage equality lawsuit. In an August 31st report, the island nation's Royal Gazette newspaper quoted attorney Mark Pettengill, who represents Winston Godwin and Greg DeRoche, that he and his clients look forward to the full hearing of this important human rights issue. The country's former attorney general is representing the couple pro bono. The case grew out of the refusal of the registrar general to process the couple's marriage application. The lawsuit argues that the denial violates provisions of Bermuda's Human Rights Act. In his refusal letter, the registrar cited Section 15 of the Matrimonial Causes Act, which stipulates that a marriage is void if the parties are not male and female. A date for the High Court hearing has yet to be announced.
The highest court in New York has expanded the definition of parenthood by deciding that separated same-gender couples each have the right to seek visitation and custody of their children, even if they aren't the biological or adoptive parent. The state's Court of Appeals ruled on August 30th that the existing standard requiring a biological or adoptive connection had become unworkable in light of society's increasingly varied familial relationships. The decision settled two separate cases involving estranged lesbian couples in which the birth mother had custody but refused to allow the non-biological parent visitation rights. The ruling only impacts cases where the non-biological or adoptive parent was part of the decision to raise a child. The court noted that rulings in future cases would also continue to be based on what is determined to be in the best interest of the child.
The BuzzFeed news site updated two other U.S. LGBT rights-related cases this week. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has already led two separate lawsuits filed by several states against the Obama administration's guidelines on equal treatment for transgender people on school campuses and in healthcare. He and 10 other state attorneys general and two governors weighed in this week on the ongoing battle over the anti-trans provision of North Carolina's notorious HB2. In addition to forbidding local governments from passing LGBT anti-discrimination ordinances, the law requires trans people to use public restrooms that correspond to the gender on their birth certificates rather than their gender identity. Paxton and Company this week asked U.S. District Court Judge Thomas Schroeder to put the Justice Department's lawsuit specifically challenging the trans part of HB2 on hold until lawsuits opposing other parts of the law proceed. Schroeder issued an injunction last week ordering the University of North Carolina not to enforce the so-called bathroom provisions of HB2, but it only applies to the students and employees of the state's university system who have filed a separate lawsuit against the anti-trans part of HB2.
The legal papers filed this week by Texas and the others asked the judge to delay any further actions until an appeals court can rule on a challenge to last week's injunction involving the University of North Carolina student and employee plaintiffs. The filing also cites the case of a transgender student who successfully challenged a Gloucester County, Virginia school board policy requiring him to use separate restroom and locker facilities. The school board officially asked the U.S. Supreme Court this week to hear their challenge to an appeals court ruling upholding Gavin Grimm's right to use the boys' bathroom. That appeals court ruling is already on hold, which will force Grimm to continue to use separate facilities as the new school year begins.
In other news, the Church of England has its first openly gay bishop. Nicholas Chamberlain, the Bishop of Grantham, went public before a newspaper that had threatened to out him could publish a story about his sexuality. He told the Guardian newspaper this week that it was not my decision to make a big thing about coming out, but it's not the first thing I'd say to anyone. Sexuality is part of who I am, he said, but it's my ministry that I want to focus on. Chamberlain was consecrated last year, and his sexuality is not a secret. The church's titular leader, Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby, said that he's been fully aware of Bishop Nick's long-term committed relationship. His appointment was made on the basis of his skills and calling to serve the church in the Diocese of Lincoln. He lives within the bishop's guidelines, which require him to be celibate, and his sexuality is completely irrelevant to his office. Bishop Chamberlain himself describes his relationship in terms most anyone can understand, telling The Guardian that it is faithful, loving, we are like-minded, we enjoy each other's company, and we share each other's life. The news is, however, expected to get a chilly reception from Anglican congregations in the Southern Hemisphere. Traditionalists there have long threatened to leave the Church of England over what they perceive to be creeping pro-gay acceptance in the denomination. Cure-peddling U.S. evangelicals have inflamed anti-gay sentiment among Anglicans in Asia, Latin America, and parts of Africa, particularly Uganda.
Spanish LGBT advocacy group Acropoli has lodged a complaint with Madrid's regional government against a cure-peddling therapist who claimed in a 2014 interview that heterosexuality is already in each individual, you just have to find it inside. Change therapy is the means to discovering it. The website of psychotherapist Elena Lorenzo Rego claims that everyone is born heterosexual. Her pitch includes testimony from patients she claims to have cured. One man says that he'd had sex with more than 200 men, but that after treatment, he was happily married with a daughter. Acropoli filed the complaint against Rego under Madrid's new anti-homophobia laws that came into effect in August. The group said in a statement this week that therapies that claim to heal homosexuality are false and unscientific and only serve to play with the insecurities of people that suffer not because of their homosexuality, but because of the homophobia that exists in society.
And finally, queer pride has reached the hometown of infamous Moorhead, Kentucky, County Clerk Kim Davis. 2 months after the U.S. Supreme Court's June 2015 civil marriage equality ruling, Davis attracted global attention for refusing to issue marriage licenses to lesbian and gay couples because of her religious beliefs. She became an instant celebrity in evangelical circles. Davis was eventually ordered to allow employees in the county clerk's office to issue licenses to same-gender couples, albeit without her official signature. David Moore organized Moorhead Pride, the first ever such event in eastern Kentucky. He told the Vice website that the Kim Davis controversy helped push the town's residents to decide where they stood on the issue of gay rights. Moorhead's tourism board was among the Pride event sponsors. About 50 vendors, including nonprofits, had booths at the festival. While the real Kim Davis was nowhere to be seen, a dead-on lookalike emceed speeches by Kentucky's successful marriage equality plaintiffs, a reading by 16-year-old budding transgender poet Dylan Scott, and performances by local drag artistes. Moore told Vice that it was probably the first time people had seen a drag show in their life.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 3rd, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK, Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
At the beginning, I was pretty confident, and then by the end, I felt like he was having serious doubts about his capacity to make a decision about this case in our favor.
Canadian activists waited months to find out how it would end, but you'll hear the decision in British Columbia's 2001 marriage equality case later in the program. ABC TV's sexy suspense crime drama, How to Get Away with Murder, boasts television's only Asian gay character, Oliver Hampton. Oliver has a lot in common with the actor who plays him, Human Rights Campaign Visibility Award winner Conrad Rickamora. He accepted the honor at an August 27th gala in Cleveland, Ohio.
Everything has its season, everything has its time. Show me a reason and I'll soon show you a rhyme. Cats fit on the windowsill, children fit in the snow. Why do I feel I don't fit in anywhere I go? Rivers belong where they can ramble. Belong where they can fly. I've got to be where my spirit can run free. Gotta find my corner of the sky.
It's a little ironic to be getting the Visibility Award because so much of growing up as a kid was spent trying to be invisible. I grew up in Niceville, Florida, which, if you're not familiar, is right below Alabama. It was rough, not only being gay, but having the color skin that I have. I was terrified that someone would see me as gay, and I was also terrified that I would see myself for what I naturally was. Growing up, like so many people in rural, conservative areas of the world, I was taught by my environment that there was something wrong with me. Years and years of shame build up, and they weigh you down, and they make you want to hide. But eventually, I left that small town of Niceville, Florida, and moved to a bigger town and a bigger world. And I realized that I wasn't alone, and a lot of it is because of the amazing groups like HRC that are providing so much necessary help for LGBTQ people. And I saw people on the streets of Charlotte, North Carolina, where I moved for undergrad, and then Philly, where I lived and worked for about 4 years, and New York City, of course, where people just live their lives happily and openly. And as I got older, I started seeing LGBTQ characters in the media, being created by brave writers, actors, and studio executives. So I'm happy to be playing Oliver and to be providing that visibility now for not only for gay men, but also for gay men of color and HIV-positive people. I want to thank Pete Nowak for creating How to Get Away with Murder, who also lives his life as a proud, openly gay man, and for creating two incredibly real and complex characters in Connor and Oliver, and for showing sex between two guys on primetime network TV. It's really exciting to be a part of something that's normalizing and representing what has already existed in the world since forever, and letting people all over the world know that there's nothing wrong with who you're attracted to. And of course, I have to thank Shonda Rhimes. Just for letting it exist in the universe that is Shondaland, and just for being such a badass in life in general. She's amazing. And most importantly, I want to thank my parents. It's not so easy growing up gay, but it's also probably challenging to have a child who's figuring out what it's like to grow up gay. So I want to thank my stepmom, Debbie, who, when I wrote her first, I wrote her a letter in college because I was too scared to call. But I sent it to her work because I wanted her to get it first and then talk to my dad. But the first thing that she wrote back to me was, "It's okay." And then the second thing was, "It's more important for you to be who you are than to try to be what you think other people expect you to be." My dad became a single parent when I was 7 months old. My mom left. And she told me a story about when she and my dad were their first date. And on their second date, he took us all hiking. And me and my brother, I have an older brother, we were up playing ahead. And they were trailing behind. And they were talking, and he looked at her and said, "Do you think you can tell if a child is gay," referring to me. And she said, "Well, I'm not sure, but would it matter?" And he said, "No, I just want to know if I need to be doing anything to help him." And that's when she said she fell in love with him. And this was coming from a man who was a single parent, and he was also in the military. So thanks, Dad. Thanks for providing me the space and acceptance to grow into who I am.
With his human rights campaign visibility award in hand, How to Get Away with Murder's Conrad Riccamora will become a series regular when the third season of the popular ABC TV show begins later this month. Some historical perspective on Canada's queerest epoch after this important message. You're listening to This Way Out, brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters, featuring queer history, LGBT music, and behind-the-scenes looks at relevant movies and TV shows. You can also now get CDs of our regular program by subscription, and be sure you never miss a week of This Way Out. For all the details, please visit our website at thiswayout.org.
I moved here in 1990 when I was 17. In 1993, I started a radio show called Queer FM on CITR. I had no idea at the time, but I was about to document one of the most phenomenal decades in the struggle for queer equality, 1995 to 2005. It was the decade we went from no constitutional human rights to full legal marriage.
That's the story of This Way Out's veteran Vancouver correspondent Heather Kitching, as told in her award-winning CITR documentary, Queer Decade, 1995 to 2005.
In recent weeks, we've heard Heather recall the legal battles that established LGBT rights, redefined the meaning of spouse, and ended censorship by Canadian customs agents. In part four, the news may not be as good, but the spirit of the movement is strong.
Going to get married. Going to the chapel and we're going to get married.
In 2001, the battle for full legal marriage rights for same-sex couples finally came to the fore. Eight BC couples had launched a court case seeking full marriage equality. There were similar cases going forward in Ontario and Quebec. Lawyers argued the case in the BC Supreme Court in August of 2001. What you're about to hear is a rather tongue-in-cheek recap of that hearing. One of the couples threw a party at their house after it wrapped up. I interviewed people while they were, shall we say, unwinding. The first voice you'll hear belongs to Dave Short, one half of one of the couples suing for marriage. The other guy with a New Zealand accent is John Fisher. He was the executive director of EGAL.
First of all, like, what's your impression of how the case went?
I had my doubts. At the beginning, I was pretty confident that the judge took the position that marriage was up for debate. And then by the end, I felt like he was having serious doubts about his capacity to make a decision about this case in our favor.
I concur.
Really?
Yeah, really. No, okay, you want me to elaborate, don't you? I can tell. I agree. I mean, I think that this is, in fact, an easy case. All we're doing is coming to the court and asking the judge to apply the law. We've won this case already on the issue of the application of the constitutional principle to same-sex relationships. There are previous cases from the Supreme Court that are directly on point that say definitions of spouse which exclude us cannot be justified. The arguments that have been raised by the government, by the interveners, are the same old arguments we've heard for years. There was nothing new here. They used to come to court and say spouse is inherently heterosexual, it involves procreation, heterosexual units need to be maintained in society or else chaos will follow. They said all the same things in this hearing, except they just substituted the word marriage for the word spouse. And yet, while we've won, I think, on the legal principles previously, there is something about the institution of marriage which still strikes at the hearts and minds of some heterosexuals as something which is just a big social institution that can't be changed. Obviously, the scale of the issue is not relevant for constitutional or legal purposes. The judge still has a responsibility to apply the charter, apply the law, and find in our favor. Nonetheless, I think that the interveners against us were successful in essentially creating concerns within the judge about what he's being asked to do, and that creates concerns with us that he may be influenced by that and find against us. But, of course, all that remains to be seen.
How did you feel about the performance of all of the different lawyers who were acting in favor of the petitioners?
Well, all our team was great. The others, I wasn't persuaded at all. I thought the AG of Canada was silly, and the interveners against us were just offensive. That's my summary. Do you want me to elaborate on that at all?
If you could, that would be great.
Okay. Well, the Attorney General of Canada was not terribly persuasive. For me, one of the memorable moments of the hearing was when she described heterosexual procreation as the historical purpose of marriage rather than the historical purpose. And, of course, we were rolled with laughter when the judge acknowledged that many people would probably agree with her that this was a historical purpose.
And what did you guys think of the judge in the case?
Well, I think if he finds in our favor, he's great. If he finds against us, then clearly there are fundamental points that he's not grasped.
So it's, we'll see whether what we think about him until the ruling.
That's right.
If he doesn't find in our favor, what happens from here? Can we appeal?
Mass suicide.
Thank you, Dave. Or that is one option, as Dave has identified. The other alternative is we could appeal, and I think probably that is what we'll be recommending to our clients.
The decision came down from the courts less than 3 months later. This is another one of the litigants in the case. Her name is Tanya Chambers.
I was checking my email at a little, like, 24-hour 7-Eleven type store, and when I found, oh, bad news, we lost. So it wasn't exactly a great day. I was frustrated and angry and sad. And I think the thing that hit me the most is I took it a lot more personal than I thought I would. that it wasn't just an attack on gay couples, that it was like, you're not good enough. Your relationship, even though we're discriminating against you, it doesn't matter. You're not good enough to deserve to be married.
If losing the marriage case was a blow to the community, what happened next was much, much worse. In November of 2001, word went out that a man had been murdered in Stanley Park. 41-year-old Aaron Webster had been swarmed by a group of young men who beat him with baseball bats and pool cues. They found him in a gay cruising area. Anti-gay assaults had been going on in the West End for years. A gay park board commissioner named Duncan Wilson had been beaten in 1996. The murder of Aaron Webster became like a focal point for the community's rage. The day after it happened, Jim Diva, the co-owner of Little Sisters, organized a march and rally. This is him speaking.
Society has somehow begun to accept us. The polls are going up in our favor. But yet this violence continues. It's like we've lived in a state of terrorism since we've come out. And I think it's time that we say that we will not put up with this terrorism anymore. We will not be looking behind our shoulders to see if there's a gang of young men out there to kill us.
The police charged four men with Webster's murder. Three were convicted. But remember that sentencing legislation that the government passed back in 1995? The one that allowed judges to hand down stiffer sentences for hate crimes against minorities? Well, the Crown never asked for it. And that led to more outrage.
The outrage goes to school in part five of Queer Decade.
In April of 97, I put forward some books for district approval about same-gender families, and they banned them.
The Chief Justice of the court said tolerance is always age-appropriate.
The Surrey School Board struggle is remembered when the saga of Canada's LGBT push for equality continues on This Way Out.
Queer Decade 1995 to 2005 was written and produced by me, Heather Kitching. Madeline Taylor engineered the interviews. Queer Decade uses music composed by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Details are at http://creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0. The compositions are called Shades of Spring, Walking Along, Spellbound, Acid Jazz, Chipperdoodle Volume 2, EDM Detection Mode, Ether Disco, Pyro Flow, Danger Storm, Lightness Dawn, Babylon, Son of a Rocket, String Disco, Your Call, and Basement Floor. Queer Decade is a production of CITR Radio and the UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Jessica Andrea, Wenzel Jones, and Heather Kitching contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Check out the latest program information and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email TWORadio@AOL.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on Contact FM, Hamilton, New Zealand, Experiment FM, Ames, Iowa, Grateful Dread Public Radio, Nashville, Tennessee, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA and Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Terence McKenna built a huge following by developing unconventional and often startling ideas about history, human consciousness, science, and politics. Today we feature a talk given by the philosopher, writer, and intellectual provocateur about who's in control or not, about the bizarre beliefs humans adopt, about the role of culture and love and beauty, and about what science can and cannot explain. And that's just scratching the surface of a talk delivered by McKenna in San Francisco in 1998, a year and a half before his death. McKenna is author of, among other books, Food of the Gods, True Hallucinations, and The Invisible Landscape, co-authored with Dennis McKenna. Today, we are pleased to present portions of Terence McKenna's talk at Fort Mason. It's called Dreaming Awake at the End of Time. And to offer you that full two-hour presentation, recorded and produced by Sound Photosynthesis, as a thank you gift for pledging your financial support to KPFA this hour. Here are the phone numbers. You can call anytime this hour, 510-848-5732. Excuse me. Why don't we go with the toll-free number, 1-800-439-5732. Toll-free, 1-800-439-5732, also known as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. The complete talk on MP3 CD is your thank you gift for an $80 pledge to KPFA. The talk on DVD is yours for a pledge of $100 or more. And we've also got the combo pack of three talks by Terence McKenna, a total of 5 hours of information and insight for a discounted pledge of $200 to this, your community, wherever you are in the world, your community radio station. Okay, let's go now to the comments of Terence McKenna speaking to a packed house in San Francisco in December 1998.
And I start by recalling an observation from someone whose name rarely falls from my lips, and that would be Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff said at one point, or was known to comment, that people are asleep, he said. And he, by implication, suggested people awaken. Well, so thinking about this comment that people are asleep, I see several implications. I ask myself, what is awake in my own notion? And I thought to myself, awake is, for me, awake is where the laws of physics are fully operable. You know, hurled objects shatter, electricity shocks, I cannot fly. The laws of physics are in operation. In that domain, I consider myself to be fully awake. Now, in terms of occult and spiritual traditions, the admonition to awaken always seems to imply that higher consciousness is approached through an expansion of clarity and awareness. And I that seems obvious. I don't argue with it as a rationalist. But as somebody who has run the edges, I've noticed something somewhat counterintuitive to that teaching, and it's this. It's that to contact the cosmic giggle, to have the flow of casuistry begin to give off synchronistic ripples, white caps in the billows of the coincidental ether, if you will, to achieve that, requires a precondition is a kind of unconsciousness, a kind of drifting, a certain taking your eye off the ball, a certain assumption that things are simpler than they are, almost always precedes what Mircea Eliade called the rupture of plane that indicates, you know, that there is an archetypal world, an archetypal power behind profane appearances. And in my own life, for those of you who are conversant with my output, when I went to the Amazon in 1971 and had the experiences that are described in True Hallucinations, I had been, for many months before that, in Asia, smuggling, hanging out, and I had taken my eye off the ball. I had become very gentle, very relativistic in my approach to other people's opinions and behaviors. I was easygoing, is what I'm trying to say. Too easygoing. And in that situation of semi-unconsciousness and openness, the cosmic giggle approaches. And I compare this to sleep, or to states that lie between waking and sleeping. And so, again, an odd take on this remark of Gurdjieff's. I remember someone many years ago said to me, they evoked the symbol of the yin and the yang, the two tiers folded against each other within a circle. And this person, who was no rishi, roshi, geshe, or guru, but simply observant, said, it's not the black side, it's not the white side, it's the interface, it's the edge. And I found, by observing sleep, and some of you may recall the motto in Athanasius Kircher's Amphitryon Sapientium that's chiseled over the alchemist's doorway. I can't do it in Latin, but it says, while sleeping, watch. While sleeping, watch. And I've noticed that while going to sleep, there is a barrier, a place in the process of going to sleep that is like a mercurial edge. It's a river. It's a zone of hypnagogia. You often pass through it post-orgasm. It's a place of drifting amoeboid-colored after-image lights and then true hallucination, images, strange, transcendental or transpersonal images. Well, so then, so far in the context of pursuing this extended metaphor about sleep, I've talked basically, essentially about the individual's relationship to the concept, to the fact. But there's also a social or a political, a species-wide implication. It occurs to me that at any given moment, because of the way the planet is as a thing, some considerable percentage of human beings are asleep, always, and many are awake. And so if the world soul is made of the collective consciousness of human beings, then it is never entirely awake. It is never entirely asleep. It exists in some kind of indeterminate zone. And this, to me, is the clue to understanding something that is personally fascinating to me. And it revolves around why people believe such weird things. And why, either as a consequence of the approach of the millennium or the breakdown of traditional values or the density of electromagnetic radiation or for some reason, a balkanization of epistemology is taking place. And what I mean by that is there is no longer a commonality of understanding. I mean, for some people, quantum physics provides the answers. Their next door neighbor may look to the channeling of archangels with equal fervor. I mean, if this is not a balkanization of epistemology, I don't know what it is. It is accompanied by a related phenomenon, which is technology or the historical momentum of things is creating such a bewildering social milieu that the monkey mind cannot find a simple story, a simple creation myth or redemption myth to lay over the crazy contradictory patchwork of profane techno consumerist post McLuhanist electronic pre-apocalyptic existence. And so into that dimension of anxiety created by this inability to parse reality rushes a bewildering variety of squirrely notions, epistemological cartoons, if you will, that, and conspiracy theory, in my humble opinion. I'm somewhat immune to paranoia, so those of you who aren't, you know, gaze in wonder. conspiracy theory is a kind of epistemological cartoon about reality. I mean, isn't it so simple to believe that things are run by the Greys and that all we have to do is trade sufficient fetal tissue to them and we can solve our technological problems? Or isn't it comforting to believe that the Jews are behind everything, or the Communist Party, or the Catholic Church, or the Masons? Well, these are epistemological cartoons. It's, you know, kindergarten stuff in the art of amateur historiography. I believe that the truth of the matter is far more terrifying, that the real truth that dare not speak itself is that no one is in control. absolutely no one. You know, you don't understand Monica. You don't understand Netanyahu. It's because nobody is in control. This stuff is ruled by the equations of dynamics and chaos. Now, there may be entities seeking control. The World Bank, the Communist Party, the rich, the somebody others. But to seek control is to take enormous aggravation upon yourself. Because this process that is underway will take the control freak by the short and curly and throw them against the wall. It's like trying to control a dream, you see. The global destiny of the species is somehow unfolding with the logic of a dream. Well, now a Jungian would say, no surprise here, history is the collective dream of humanity. It is run by archetypal energies. It is downloaded by the zeitgeist into the various milieus and epochs of which it is composed. This seems reasonable to me. I don't want to give you the impression it's too linear to understand that what I am saying is that awake is good, asleep is bad. What I would rather do is explain this whole gradient of possible positioning vis-a-vis your life and your destiny, these choices that you have, and then have people understand that they choose, you choose to be asleep or partially asleep or fully awake or to be one part of the time and in some situations and one part of the time and in other situations.
That's Terrence McKenna. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on KPFA. We'll return to much more of his talk called Dreaming Awake at the End of Time, given in San Francisco. It's 2 hours long, and I want to let you know a little bit about how you can get some Terrence McKenna for your very own and how you can help KPFA and Against the Grain. And, you know, this is listener-sponsored radio. Terrence McKenna, you may never have heard his voice or his name before, except maybe on this program and maybe on this radio station. And, you know, I really like to find philosophers and thinkers, and in this case, ethnobotanists and writers and lecturers like Terrence McKenna to present to people. He as Mickey Hart says, probes the depths of the great mysteries of the mind. He asks the big questions. He rides the edge. The artist Alex Gray says McKenna's ideas are rare jewels discovered during expeditions to the heights and depths of inner space. Philosopher, thinker, highly regarded writer, visionary scholar. You can get the full-length presentation, two-hour presentation, Dreaming Awake at the End of Time, for an $80 pledge to KPFA. That comes to you on an MP3 CD. The DVD, so you get your front row seat to this talk, is $100. A $100 pledge to KPFA gets you that DVD. And then we offered on Monday this amazing Terrence McKenna super pack with three talks by Terrence McKenna, including Dreaming Awake at the End of Time, including Taxonomy of Illusion, which we presented excerpts of on Monday's Against the Grain, and then also Mind and Time, Spirit and Matter, a talk about human consciousness and evolution and all kinds of amazing things. That's yours for a $200 pledge to KPFA. You can pledge at 1-800-HEY-KPFA, which is the same as 1-800-439-KPFA, which is the same as 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can also donate securely online at kpfa.org, kpfa.org. The less you ask for, the more we get, right? Because it costs money to get the DVDs or CDs and to send them out to you. But we are totally willing to do that if you want Terrence McKenna to listen to at your leisure. And there is, you know, 2 hours just on this one talk, Dreaming Awake at the End of Time, portions of which we are presenting today. $80 pledge, $100 for the DVD, $200 for the McKenna Super Pack of three talks. Or you can write, not ask for anything, and then all that money that you give comes to KPFA, and your contribution is discounted because it's tax deductible. 1-800-439-5732, and we love to hear from people via kpfa.org. It's quick. It's easy. On kpfa.org, you can do some shopping. All the different thank you gifts we've offered thus far this September Fund Drive is available there for you to see and to pick and to choose. Or maybe you just want to give to KPFA because you know that KPFA really needs the money, particularly at this moment. So Terrence McKenna studied art history and then ecology and conservation at UC Berkeley. He wrote a number of very highly regarded books. He was born actually in 1946 in Colorado. He's lived at various times in Colorado, Los Altos, Berkeley, Occidental, Hawaii, sought after lecturer. Maybe you understand from what you've been hearing this hour of why the man was so sought after and so interesting and so funny and so insightful. And you can get some Terrence McKenna for your very own by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. But let's return. Let's return to more of Terrence McKenna, the talk again, Dreaming Awake at the End of Time, given in San Francisco less than 2 years before his death at the age of 53.
Now, if in fact we exist inside some kind of morphogenetic field that is created by the sum total of human minds on the planet, and if in fact in half or more of those minds at any given moment the rules of the dream hold sway, then it is no surprise that when we make our way into society, or just when we live our lives, there's an eeriness to it. There's a fatedness to it. There's a plottedness to it. We are inside some kind of engine of narrative, I believe. Some science fiction writers such as Greg Egan and others have suggested that this could even be a form of recorded medium. You can see the thumbprints of editors on our reality if you are truly paying attention. I mean, if you're a devotee of the theory of stochastic and random unfolding of events, then you have to look very carefully at how unrandom and how mythical and archetypal most people's lives are. If you take psychedelics and hurl yourself to the edge and spend time with strange Aboriginal people in remote parts of the world, the cosmic giggle becomes your friend. But in fact, ordinary people's lives, everyone's lives, are touched by deep magic. And the primary datum is experience, and then the models are built backward from the primary data without prejudice and in an attempt to transcend historical momentum. And when I do that, what I see is that the carrier of the field of the cosmic giggle in most people's lives is love. Love is some kind of output which messes with the entropic tendency toward probabilistic behavior in nature. What do I mean by that? I mean, you can be the janitor at Microsoft and the vice president and chief of operations, his daughter can bring him lunch one day, and you can, from a distance, have your eye fall upon her and fall in love with her. And, you know, from that point to having the five children she bears you go off to Harvard and the Sorbonne, it's just a matter of running the clock forward. I mean, these things have, I mean, to you it may seem like a miracle, but to those of us who are students of human happenstance, it's inevitable. I mean, you can launch your story. And I've, you know, in the course of taking psychedelics and looking at my life and other people's lives and narrative, I think that the secret of, I don't want to say anything as pretentious as transcendence or enlightenment, but the secret of taking hold of one's destiny is to understand that one is a character. A character is a different thing than this model you inherit out of the idea that you're a three-dimensional animal inside a democracy with a Christian heritage and, you know, a Dewey Decimal cataloging system or whatever. Anyway, these are some of the notions that occur to me in the context of comparing dream on many scales. It's, you have to really struggle, I think, to believe that you actually live inside the model of reality that science and Newtonian physics and the mathematical analysis of nature have given us. You know, not to get too philosophical here, but for positivist philosophers, everything that is important, color, feeling, taste, tone, ambition, apprehension, appetition, these things are called secondary qualities. In other words, they're peripheral. They arise at a lower level of understanding. They are somehow determined by the presence of the animal body and hence dismissible by a theory of pure abstraction, which says, you know, what is real is spin, charge, angular momentum. None of these things are very rich concepts for a living human being. Who knows what any of these things are, you know? So, one, I mean, there, we don't have time in a situation like this to explore all the implications of this dream analogy that I'm pursuing. But one that interests me is the plasticity of time in the dream. And I think I would argue, as the devil's advocate, that it is the plasticity of historical time and the acceleration, the sense of an out-of-control spin up or spin down into new domains of possibility that is the strongest evidence present at hand that we are in some kind of dream. I've struggled my whole life with, I've always believed or I've always felt the power of the statement, the world is made of language. But, of course, you think about this proposition for 30 seconds, and the question that arises then is, if the world is made of language, then why isn't it the way I want it to be? You know, why does it have this prepotent momentum for its own, it has its own raison d'etre, even if it is language? Well, I think, and it's appropriate to speak of this in to an audience as digitally sophisticated as I assume you must be, I think the primary insight that has been secured, the primary contribution of 20th century thinking, if you will, is to have understood finally that information is primary, that this world, this cosmos, this universe, this body and soul are all made of information. Information is a deeper and more primary concept than space, time, matter, energy, charge, spin, angular momentum. The world is made of language. The implication for the digerati is that reality can therefore be hacked. If reality is made of language, then what we're saying is that it's code. And if it's code, then it is far more deeply open to manipulation than we ever dared dream. I mean, we've been messing around on the desktop, opening files with religions and political systems and xenophobic theories of racial superiority, all this crap that haunts the human historical adventure. It means we have not addressed the deeper levels.
No, I agree with Terence McKenna about that. We have not explored or examined the deeper levels, and Terence McKenna helps us do that. He allows us to do that. He invites us to do that. Terence McKenna is our featured speaker today on Against the Grain on listener-supported KPFA, and I'm CS, and in the next 3 minutes, and then we'll go back to more of Terence McKenna. This talk is called Dreaming Awake at the End of Time. We have been given a matching pledge of $300 from Ismael in San Jose. So thank you so much, Ismael, for your generous pledge of support. And that means that he will match your pledge dollar for dollar up to $300. And I think we can do this in the 3 minutes that we have to talk to you about Terence McKenna. So the thank you gifts are the full-length talk on CD. It's almost a two-hour presentation. It is a two-hour presentation that Terence McKenna gave in San Francisco. That's just an $80 pledge to get the entire presentation on MP3 CD. Think about getting the entire talk on DVD, because Terence McKenna is not just a voice to behold, but a sight to behold. He's very animated, always very engaged with his ideas and with the audience. And you can get that talk on DVD, this talk on DVD, for a $100 pledge to KPFA. And then the Terence McKenna Super Pack, which is always a very popular thank you gift, because it's 5 hours of Terence McKenna, 3 MP3 CDs, 3 extended talks, including Taxonomy of Illusion, portions of which we presented to you on Against the Grain 2 days ago. You get almost 5 hours of Terence McKenna on 3 CDs for a $200 pledge to KPFA. The magic phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We've got about 90 seconds left to make this match. Your dollars get doubled by Ismael in San Jose. And this is all about raising money for KPFA to keep it alive. To keep it alive. It's that simple. This is kind of a survival fund drive. This is one of those true make or break kinds of propositions. KPFA.org is a wonderful way to pledge. You can also send us a message. You can type in your message to myself or Sasha or to anybody here at KPFA or to the station in general and tell us how you feel about this station and about the kinds of voices you hear, the kinds of insights and commentary and culture and news and public affairs and political affairs and cultural criticism. And, of course, the wonderful music and theater that you hear on KPFA 24/7. We exist for you. That's what we exist. We exist here for you. Other people have given so that you can listen in, that you can hear these voices. You can hear my voice. Other people have given so you can listen. So I'm hoping that you will now give so you and other people can listen. It's a reciprocal kind of arrangement, and it's a two-way street. It's a two-way street of us giving and you giving and us receiving and you receiving 24/7, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. We made that match. Thank you so much. And now we all get rewarded with more of Terence McKenna, the philosopher, the ethnobotanist, the writer, the sought-after lecturer, the guy who Tom Robbins described as having the ability to let out the waist on the trousers of perception and raise the hemline of reality. Terence McKenna speaking at San Francisco.
And in thinking about this and the relationship to dream and human culture, I have realized that cultures are like operating systems. We are like hardware. The human animal is a piece of biological wetware slash hardware. And it has been, we know, pretty much as we confront it today for at least 140,000 years. At Classis River cave mouth in South Africa, they have excavated Homo sapiens skeletons 100,000 years old, and that person could have sat in the front row here tonight and nobody would have batted an eyebrow. So the human hardware has been in place for a while. What has changed rapidly in comparison to the rates of biological evolution are the operating systems. The people who excavated Ur, which was at that time thought to be the world's first city, and in any case is a city 7 millennia old, when they excavated the central plaza at Ur, they discovered that a black basaltic slab had been set up there by the earliest kings of Ur, and that was the cultural operating system. And if in a deal trading goats for olives, a dispute arose, people had reference to the central operating system, and these things were determined. Well, now, Ur 101 was fine for olives and goat trading, but it didn't support higher mathematics. It didn't support rational exploration of nature. It didn't support astrological knowledge about the movement of the stars. As we have gone forward through culture, we have swapped out these operating systems. And at each swap out, there has been a lot of hair pulling and cussing and screaming. Anyone who has installed a new operating system is really familiar with that sickening from the bowels kind of coldness, as you know, you realize it all hangs by a thread. Now, this situation or this operating system metaphor, I think, is a useful one for understanding, and again, a circle closes, the balkanization of epistemology that causes me such anxiety. If you meet an Aboriginal person from the Amazon, for example, they may be running Witoto 3.0 as their operating system. Nicely supports animistic magic, huge capacity when it comes to making fish traps and bird traps. Witoto is a powerful operating system for a rainforest Aboriginal. In our culture, you know, there are, I have no idea, at least 10 or 20 operating systems all going at the same time. Some will run Mormonism. Some will support Catholicism. Others, Kabbalah goes at the speed of light. Others support quantum physics. Some support econometrics. Others support political correctness. And these things are mutually exclusive. And so looking at this and looking at this clash of operating systems, I've come to the conclusion, and some of you may have heard me say this before, that culture is not your friend. That's the final conclusion. You see, well, this came to me a few months ago when I had my yearly physical. And as I was buttoning up, my doctor said to me, he said, you know, in the 19th century, most people your age were dead. And I realized that that this was true, and that one of the, among all the revolutions that we are enduring, one of them is that we live nearly twice as long as people lived very recently in the past. Well, culture is a kind of neoteny. For those of you who are not biologists, neoteny is the retention of juvenile characteristics into adulthood. It's used to describe animal behavior. For instance, I'll give the most spectacular example of neoteny. There is a kind of animal which lives in ponds in Africa, and it reproduces like fish. It lays eggs on the bottom of these ponds. More fish-like animals come from these eggs and so forth. However, if the pond dries up, the creature undergoes metamorphosis and becomes an animal somewhat like a gecko and lays eggs, and from these eggs come creatures that are like geckos. In other words, this is an animal which actually achieves sexual maturity in two forms, depending on environmental stress. Spectacular example of neoteny. Turning to human beings, a less spectacular example, but relevant to us, is our general body hairlessness compared to other primates. We look like fetal apes. Human beings look like fetal apes. Why? What is neoteny? Well, this is hotly debated among evolutionary biologists. But the point I want to make is a socio-political comment, which is culture itself is some kind of neotenizing force. Because what culture provides is a bunch of rules, so you don't have to think, and a bunch of myths, so you don't have to think again. Culture has all the answers, you know. You want to know where people came from? Well, when the sky god got out of his canoe at first waterfall and took a leak, then we, the true people, appeared like ants, and we've been living here ever since.
That's Terence McKenna, and the talk is Dreaming Awake at the End of Time. He gave it in San Francisco at Fort Mason. It's a two-hour-long presentation, and a lot of it has to do with, right, the operating system that is driving us and why it is and what it is and what rules have been established so we don't have to think, and how do we think in new ways? How do we break out of established patterns of thinking and understanding? Terence McKenna, philosopher, writer, lecturer, ethnobotanist, public intellectual, really an amazing mind. It's clear that he thought and read a ton, and he incorporated so many insights into his lectures. This lecture, Dreaming Awake at the End of Time, yours for an $80 pledge to KPFA. It's 2 hours. On MP3 CD, and it's also 2 hours on DVD. Terence McKenna for a $100 pledge to KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. You can also donate, and we hope you do, at kpfa.org, because it's easy, it's quick, and you can choose whatever you want, or you can choose nothing at all. And you can also write us a message, such as Elizabeth in Walnut Creek sent us a message saying, I am a better person because of KPFA. The number is 1-800-439-5732. William in San Jose sent us a message. via kpfa.org. I am so grateful to have KPFA and all who support it. I am so grateful to all the familiar voices that I welcome into my home, my car, wherever I can tune in. I thank you, thank you, thank you for all you do every day. Your hard work is so essential. The importance of this radio station / community-powered radio cannot be measured. I wish I could give more. Consider giving not today, not later today, not tomorrow, not in a week, but right now, and getting a, you can get the McKenna Super Pack, which is three CDs that contain three talks that contain 5 hours of insight and information from Terrence McKenna. Three MP3 CDs, a $200 pledge to KPFA. So you got the $80 talk on CD, you got the $100 talk on DVD, and you got the three talk Terrence McKenna Super Pack for a $200 pledge to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. McKenna is talking about transcending the surface noise, getting around and behind the surface noise, going to the underlying questions. You know, we live our lives on the surface, and sometimes that's not enough. I would say it's not enough. And McKenna is a seeker, and I am a seeker of sorts, and I know many of you out there are seekers, and you can get a very interesting and provocative and insightful guide in the form of Terrence McKenna on CD or DVD or on three CDs by calling 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. He's encouraging us to live on the edge. He's about investing the world, our world, with meaning. He's saying that our monkey mind, as he and others, including Buddhists, call it, often makes us unable to grasp or parse reality. He says we believe things for reasons of comfort and for reasons of convenience. And he is interested in what determines our behavior, what motivates our conduct, and how we might live more productively and more meaningfully. Now I am given a match, which makes this all the more urgent. 10 minutes left in the hour, and we've given a match of $800 from Sean in Sausalito and Anonymous in Cupertino. So you've been waiting. If you've been waiting to have your dollars doubled by other generous supporters of KPFA, and maybe you have only $25 to give or $65 to give, which will, by the way, get you as a thank you gift a KPFA T-shirt. But maybe you have $80 to get the talk on CD. Maybe you have $100 to get the talk on DVD. Maybe you have $200 to give to get the McKenna Super Pack. 1-800-439-5732. Your dollars are doubled. Your dollars are doubled, but only for the next now 9 minutes. 9 minutes. Sean Sausalito, thank you so much. Anonymous in Cupertino, whoever you are, thank you so much. You've put up a lot of money, and you are challenging other listeners to KPFA, to Against the Grain, to come forward, to give what they can. If you can give, as I said, without a gift, then, and by the way, you know, I have just stuff. I've got so much stuff in my house. I'm walking over stuff. I'm tripping over stuff. And, of course, a lot of it has to do with, you know, the books I'm reading for this program. But I don't need more stuff. If you don't need more stuff, if you don't want more stuff, but you want KPFA, give us a call, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or go online. Go online to kpfa.org. kpfa.org. We know a lot of you listen to us online, to Against the Grain online. You hear podcasts of Against the Grain online. AgainstTheGrain.org, by the way, is your entree to that. Give us a call. Give us what you can. Share what you can. And maybe you want Terrence McKenna to share his amazing mind and his amazing insights with you. Sasha Lilly is with me. I'm C.S. Song. This is listener-sponsored, listener-supported KPFA. We need you right now.
We do. We need you to call 1-800-439-5732 or go to kpfa.org, where you can see all sorts of thank you gifts on offer, including the Terrence McKenna Super Pack. You can choose from those, or you can just make your pledge simply and ask for no thank you gift in return, knowing that what you get is KPFA, knowing that what you get is Against the Grain. And as CS said, your money is actually doubled right now, so there's no better time to do it. And, you know, if you're someone who really appreciates KPFA, who appreciates Against the Grain, and has given, perhaps not very recently. This is a wonderful time to support us, and even if you have given recently, I should say, because although every time we come to you during a fund drive and say we need your funds right now, we're listener-sponsored, hence we need you to come through for us each time, never has KPFA's future been so, well, a big question mark. And we need you to step forward right now and make sure that we continue into the future. We are not the sky is falling types on this program, but the situation is actually quite dire. 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, kpfa.org. If you can afford to give a lot, this is really the time to do it. So if you're able to give a very large pledge, we will be very, very grateful. If you're not able to afford that, we totally understand. But this is the moment to pull out the stops, and your money is doubled. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA.
I was talking to a scholar of the Stoics, the ancient thinkers and philosophers, and he said, you know, the Stoics would say, do this experiment where just for a moment you think about, you imagine that something you love is gone, it's dead. And that's not a, it's not to, you know, to engage in sort of morbid, maudlin behavior or attitude. It's to, because then you think, oh, well, then I have it here. So, wow, it's here, and I really appreciate it because it would be so terrible if it were gone. And, I think if you could think about, just for a moment, KPFA not being a part of your life, and think about what you would do to bring KPFA back into your life. What would you give to have KPFA back in your life? And KPFA is not to be taken for granted. KPFA is not always going to be here just because some people, 1 in 7 of our listeners, give to KPFA. KPFA will be here because and only if people come together in a collective, in solidarity with each other, and give to KPFA of their own free will. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We're getting also pledges online at kpfa.org. Thank you so much. We have a match of $800 to make. We are, and I'm just looking here at the board, we are about $280 toward that match of $800. So we have quite a bit of ground to cover in the last 4.5 minutes. Terrence McKenna is your thank you gift. Terrence McKenna is your thank you gift. His voice, his mannerisms, if you get the DVD of the talk for $100, and all the insights on the Super PAC, which is a $200 pledge. It's a deeply discounted, by the way, Super PAC. If we offered you each of those three MP3 CDs, one at a time, it would probably be close to $350. But we've combined them, and it's $200 from almost 5 hours of this man who's been called a prophet, a madman. Timothy Leary called him one of the 5 or 6 most important people on the planet. And he is talking about how we have a maladaptive relationship to reality, how we have become, in a sense, inappropriate to ourselves. He talks about everything from human intelligence to egoism to greed to culture to the role of women to the kinds of illusions we are operating under. He says our house is burning. He says we must arouse from our stupor. He says the greatest challenge to human intelligence is right now. You can give, you can become part of this project, this collective project that is KPFA, that is Against the Grain. You can get your dollars doubled. Why not get your dollars doubled? Why not have somebody say, oh, well, this person's giving $80 to you. I'm giving $80 because that person's giving $80. Because if we don't make this $800 match, we don't get that $800 from Sean in Sausalito or Anonymous in Cupertino. Or at least we have to offer the money back. And, you know, actually, we haven't even gotten the money. So we there's nothing to offer back to these people. 1-800-439-5732. Less than 3 minutes left. We can do it, and we can do it together.
We can, but it really comes down to you. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or kpfa.org. And I wanted to add to your list, CS, of all the many reasons to pledge right now, that your donations are tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law, which is a fantastic thing come year end to give to this incredible entity that was started by pacifists 67 years ago, a wonderful way to divert some of your taxes to away from the military and to this really remarkable institution. But as CS said, it's not an institution you can take for granted. We try to be there for you. We hope you'll be there for us as well. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or kpfa.org. $800 is on the line right now. We have a minute and a half to go.
Terence McKenna disrupts conventional narratives. He provokes us to think outside the box. And maybe that's what KPFA does for you. I know if you listen to KPFA, that is what KPFA does for you. Maybe that's what Against the Grain does for you. If you listen to our program, that is what Against the Grain does for you. And if McKenna makes us rethink our assumptions, our common sense, our instinctive reactions to phenomena we encounter every day, maybe you want to encourage that. Maybe you want to say yes to that. Maybe you want to vote for precisely that intellectual project, precisely that, in a sense, emotional, affective project as well. 1-800-439-5732. Less than a minute to go. It's not too late. It's not too late to make your pledge, to say your piece, to contribute to something that's so much bigger than any one of us, any individual. If we all act as sort of individuals, then how does anything major get done? KPFA is a major player on the media landscape, and if you agree that it needs to stick around and you want some KPFA in return, you want some Terence McKenna in return, give us a call right now, not too late, 1-800-439-5732. We've got 20 seconds left to go. You want to be surprised, you want to be provoked, you want to be inspired, you want to be humored in a sense. You want to find some great humor and verve in Terence McKenna. Give us a call.